Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio by Jubalith Moore. Oh, my goodness. And here is Eugenie right on time.
Hi,
good morning, Eugenie. How are you? Wow.
I'm good. How are
about
you?
I'm fine. Yeah, Eugenie Chan is joining us. She's dramaturg on This Linger in Life, a Theater of Yugen production that's opening June 5th, and it's having a short run, June 5th through 14th in San Francisco, celebrating the Theater of Yugen's 35th anniversary season. Good morning, women. How are you?
Good morning.
Great.
Wow. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. So I guess before we jump in, maybe I should tell people a little bit about you this wonderful production that is having its world premiere. So New York-based playwright Shiori Miyagawa's This Linger in Life, yeah, will have a limited two-week run in San Francisco this June as part of Theater Yugen's 35th anniversary season, as I already mentioned, and is inspired by nine Japanese no plays from the 14th century. And This Linger in Life will feature 28 characters and 24 scenes performed by an ensemble of nine actors of diverse ethnicities. And there are also some gender-crossing roles in the play. For example, the young warrior is played by a woman and his mother is played by a male actor. But before we tell you more details about the play, let me tell you a little bit about our guest this morning, Jubalith Moore, who is returning to our studios after having been on, but earlier in this 35th anniversary year, is a graduate of Bard College. Ms. Moore is the artistic director of Theater of Yugen and has been with the company and a student of Yuriko Doi since 1993. She acts, directs, and writes for the theater and has devoted her professional life to exploring the ongoing life of traditional Japanese and contemporary American theater. Ms. Moore is a founding member of Theater Nogaku since 2001, performed the Waki role in Jeanette Shion. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Pagoda, an English language no, performed to critical acclaim in London, Dublin, Oxford, and Paris. Ms. Moore has taught Theater of Yugen winter training sessions since 2003, in addition to several other seasonal training sessions and workshops. Ms. Moore has assisted Richard Emmert in his American-based no training project and has been an artist in residence at San Francisco School of the Arts since 1998. And she's got a whole lot more you can read in the program. When you go attend, come, visit the theater to see This Lingering Life. And Eugenie, oh my goodness, I have been admiring Eugenie Chan, her work forever. In this particular production, she is dramaturg. Oh, you're welcome. She is fifth-generation San Franciscan. Her work includes Bone the Pick, Best of 2008 List, San Francisco Bay Garden, Madam Ho, which is really phenomenal, Kitchen Table, Daphne Does Dim Sum, Rancho Grande, Emile, A Chinese Play, Novelle Ah, Pilgrim, Consent, Circus, and Opera Libretto, Snake Woman. Oh, my. Well, you got a little, little applause there. That was cute. How'd you do that? There are a lot of theaters who have produced or developed her plays, which include in the West, Cutting Ball Theater, San Francisco Mime Troupe, Houston Grand Opera, and a whole lot of others. She's received commissions from the Houston Grand Opera, Cutting Ball, and San Francisco Arts Commission, Magic, Sloan Science Initiative, and the San Francisco Foundation. Currently, Eugenie is writing the San Francisco Mime Troupe's 2014 summer show with Bay Area playwrights Tanya Schaefer and Michael Sullivan. Oh, that's going to be interesting. And Michael Eugene Sullivan has a play that's having a stage reading next month as well. So you should look for that. That's going to be at the Museum of the African Diaspora, and that's going to be a free stage reading. So that should be really cool. Eugenie is resident playwright at New Dramatists, Playwrights Emerita at Cutting Ball, and alumna resident of the Playwrights Foundation. She's adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco Performing Arts and Social Justice Department. Oh, interesting. I graduated from there.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, I got a master's in writing there. At USF, Eugenie teaches Asian American performance and playwriting. Oh, so this is going to be really exciting. So now let's jump right into it. So let's start with you, Jubilith. How did you happen to find out about this Lingering Life and this wonderful playwright, Shiori Miyagawa's work?
Well, she sent it to me in the mail. It's not a very good story, I suppose. I've known Shiori Miyagawa's work for several years. I'll say the last decade. Her name has kind of floated just at the periphery of my knowing. And in 2011, she sent me a script and a nice little email and asked that I look at it. And at that point, the script was, I think, 90 pages long. And we have this funny thing at Theater of Eugen where most of our scripts are about 20 pages long. So I printed out her script, and I said, well, we'll see. And I started reading it, and I was completely hooked. And I, you know, then submitted it to the company, and I said, I think we need to do this play. I don't know who else would do it. It's so big. It's so vast. And we, you know, are so intimately familiar with the plays upon which it's based. I said, this is a play that we need to do. But it is completely unlike anything we've ever done before. It is completely a Western text-based, story-based play. So everyone was very frightened that the play was going to end up being, you know, 10 hours long because we usually put in songs and dances and, you know, our work has a very different feel. So that's kind of the negotiation that's been happening of, like, how do we Eugenize this very Western script? Where's our flavoring? Where's our touch that we put on this piece?
So then you bring in Eugenie,
right? Yes, help us.
Go ahead, Julia.
No, go for it. Go for it, please. You can say better than I.
That was my coming on board was actually quite organic because Shiori and I have known each other for quite a while. We were both literary managers at a young age, and we knew each other as dramaturgs. And then both of us started writing plays, and we crossed paths. And I've long admired Shiori's work as well as admired Shiori as a person. And you know, we're good friends too. So. Quite organic. We've shared lots of talks about aesthetics, theater, our lives as Asian American women. So, you know, it's sort of a natural progression.
Mm. and you're with Shiori right now because you're in New York, right?
Well, actually, Jubilith is with Shiori.
Yes.
Oh, Jubilith, you're in New York?
A little confusing.
Oh, wow. So you're, wow. Okay. Oh, that's so cool.
We traded places.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Really? Yeah.
Just for
Eugenie,
a bit.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes.
So, Eugenie, why don't you tell us sort of how one approaches such a work? And maybe before you do that, why don't you tell our audience what's the play about?
Oh, the play is about, well, there are many, many stories involved, but they all deal with the idea and in a way the reality or the struggle with karma. That is how one progresses in life, how one experiences and receives one's past lives, and in a way, the different facets of lives, the lives that were past, present, and in the future. So it's very much a play about transformation and transformation over time, transformation over different walks of life, transformation on a very everyday level. In fact, there's a wonderful story about hitchhikers who meet a mother who has lost her young son. So, you know, these are just hitchhikers, these backpackers, and they meet a woman who you know, has lost her young son, and she is looking for him and thinking that he is in a particular place when actually he has, you know, he's experienced a tragic death that she can't bring herself to believe and also behold. In many ways, the play is about beholding, in a way, how one holds and lives through and accepts one's lives, but also how you look at it and how you then behold it so that you can move beyond and be released into your next life or into the next phase of your current life that will lead you to the next passage. So it's very much a play that crosses time and lives. It's a wonderful, wonderful universe. It's a universe beyond our normal reality. Not to say that it's fantastical or anything like that, but it really takes into consideration and in a very dramatic way what does life mean, really.
The cast, it just sounds, you know, really, it's a real broad tapestry of lives that are traversed in the work, This Lingering Life. And some of these people, you know, they cross over into other realms, you know, that between,
yeah,
you know, the living and the dead, that line is blurred, similar to sort of the African, West African storytelling tradition. I'm thinking about, I'm drawing a blank on his name, but the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women, they actually performed the work of this particular African playwright, and he was the first to be translated into English, and then in this particular story, there was no line between those that were dead and those that were alive. For the characters even. And so that was really interesting. And I was wondering how it seems with regards to the playwright's life, her story, you know, being an immigrant, coming here at 16, I think during Clinton's presidency, you know, becoming a citizen. And really being more steeped in Western theater than in, you know, traditional Japanese theater. And that story is really interesting. So to have this particular play written, you know, by a person who has this type of embodiment must bring a sort of different kind of twist to the whole no tradition. So Jubilant, Eugenia, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think it's incredibly fascinating, the collaboration between Chiori and Jubilant, because as you said, Chiori came here as a high school student, so she her teen years and her childhood were spent in Japan, but she came here, you know, very formative age and has been here ever since then in the tradition of the West, the Western theatrical literary tradition, but, you know, very much being also someone who was born and raised in Japan and coming to know in a way as maybe almost like an outsider with two feet into the culture of origin, but not having been steeped in any Jubilant. Who Jubilant? I'm going to take a leap here, but I think you're born and raised in the States, and then Jubilant has steeped herself in the tradition of no and studied it as a scholar artist throughout most of your life, And so I think the collaboration is fascinating, so fascinating. In fact, I'm gonna do a little. So forgive me, Jubal, a little reveal of the process. But it's been so interesting to see and experience the dialogue between Jubalith and Chiori. You know, what is no, what is not no in this play? What is because really this play is a really fresh take that these no stories are just I'm losing my words here, an inspiration for Chiori to create this whole this whole new universe and her own take on these stories. So that to me is incredibly fascinating because what I also think it's a great play for Eugen to do because Eugen is redefining no for its time and place, and its time and place happens to be a particular town, San Francisco, but within a totally American culture. So I think it's just a great collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering, Jubalith, if you could talk about how well, because I believe this is Chiori's first time, writing a play like this, how the form, supports the story, because, no theater is really formal. In an interview I read, with Chiori, she talks about that, and she talks about, sort of being asked to, in different settings to be like a representative of her country. It's like, well, I'm just sort of paraphrasing here, but the United States is her country, more so than, let's say, Japan is now her country because she's been in the United States, studied here, sort of her her aesthetic has been really tuned here. So she's more a product of the West than, let's say, a product of the East. Yet, of course, she has her roots. I mean, similar to probably these ghosts that are walking around in this story. You can't get away from that. And she talks about, sort of the unconscious influences of her native culture on her work, because you can never sort of get away from who you are at one's core, even those things that one can't necessarily directly articulate. So I was wondering if you could talk about sort of how she is able, and you definitely, Jeannie, join Jubalith, how well this form, how she hangs this story on the form.
That's a great way of phrasing it. Well, I think at heart, Chiori is a fabulous playwright, and she loves the theater, and that comes shining through in this play. And it is about this wonderful embracement of the theatricality of life. The play, all the world's the stage and we are its players. And that sensibility just is a beautiful lens to see this lingering life. In terms of, for me, of staging the work, I'm seeing the work through the lens of no. And I look at the characters and I see the characters as the Waki or as the Shte or as the central figure. And that's helping me in terms of staging the work. But it's just this really interesting, delicate dance between what is in the foreground and what is in the background. Is the story in the foreground or is the form in the foreground? Or is this a case where the story slips back and the form comes forward, or the story comes forward and the form goes back? And it's a nice intimate dance between story and content and with what is actually telling the story. So, for instance, we have 9 performers and they're playing 28 characters. And so you see one actor, they'll embody, 3 or 4 different characters throughout the course of the play. And that in itself is a beautiful story and so theatrical, so delightful. You see someone, mentioned earlier was the young warrior. It's played by a woman. You see this very fine young actress, and she's a great warrior. And then she comes on later, and she's like this all giggly little girlfriend, and she's, it's wonderful to see that transformation. You're literally seeing an actor transform, which, as Eugenie said, is so much of what the play is about. And then there is this, that I've been thinking of that as very soft and very river-like, you know, like the grasshopper on the river. We're just all on this ride. And then the play is 24 scenes, and they're very quick, which is so unlike No. it's taken me a while to get accustomed to the time and the very sharp, immense clarity of Chiori's text. And that's another, actually that is in some way, it's a nod to the No. It's very modular in its structure, where she's cut one story maybe into two or three different scenes. And so we get to see, we check in with these scenes over time, and we feel that accumulation, and that is very No-like. She's created this amazing tapestry of all these stories that coexist somehow in one world, which is kind of contained by the characters from one No play of the woman with tragic hair and her brother. And they contain, they hold this whole, all these different stories. But it's very modular in structure, which is very No. And then at the, and hopefully at the end, what will hopefully be a similar experience for an audience maybe going to see No and an audience coming to see This Lingering Life, is that you'll feel the accumulation of these stories, and you'll feel the accumulations of these transformations, and a beautiful release that is possible, that I feel is, you know, sometimes only possible when you see a No play. I'm hoping that it will be possible when you experience This Lingering Life. Did that make any sense?
sure. Yeah, Eugenie, and then perhaps another question for you is, have you directed a play in this particular type of form before, a No play?
Oh,
did a dramaturge. Were the dramaturge for a play like this, you know, in the No form before now?
Actually, never. And so it was a new and it's a new and remarkable experience. In fact, I came aboard, and one of the first things I asked Chiori and Jubilith was, okay, should I, you know, like I, what I would normally do is dive into the original stories and do some research and, you know, on No and the inspirational material, the story, the actual No stories. And Chiori said no. Well, no pun intended. No, we want you to come in with as a No innocent, so that because we are ensconced and enmeshed in this world, and we want to see what you see with your fresh eye. So I came in, I think I called myself, what did I call myself? The no idiot. And Jubilith and Chiori graciously said, no, you're the no innocent. So this is entirely, a new adventure for me, and so very, very interesting. Although I have to confess that I actually have seen, I actually got to see a scene from No in Japan many, many years ago, but that was so long ago that, you know, it doesn't count as scholarship in any way. So again, it's for me a remarkable, remarkable play and production, because as Jubilith has said, so much of it is, again, about transformation and moving from one world of the living to the dead, or that in-between Bardo place, or even within one's living physical life, the transformations that come within that. I've never experienced, read, or seen a play that really, really tackles this what stage in our life are we in you know, that deals with karma in such a with such a full embrace.
Yeah, the play that I was, the book that I was speaking of, the story is My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and the author is Amos Tutuola, and he lived between 1920 and 1977, and as I mentioned in this particular story, the protagonist is straddling multiple worlds and actually takes a journey through the bush of ghosts, which is the other side, and comes back through onto the human side and to tell his story. So it's really, really quite remarkable. As someone who knows the playwright's work, Eugenie, I was wondering if you could maybe, and Jubilith, you could chime in as well, tell us sort of where this particular work sits within her her trajectory or her canon, this lingering life, because she's written about, she's got like such a rich, rich literary life. I mean, she's written up quite a few really interesting works, and actually has a couple of anthologies of her work, Thousand Years, Waiting in Other Plays, and America Dreaming in Other Plays. But then she's written, I mean, her the kind of work she's done, like, for instance, I was looking at dispatches from Amended America, which is based on interviews conducted by Godfrey Simmons and Brant Adams in the South immediately after the election of President Obama. And then she's one of the playwrights on the Dream Act Union, which is sort of looking at that bill, the Dream Act bill,
yeah,
and what that means. Yeah, so, I mean, she's like really in, you know, sort of one of those revolutionary kind of writers like yourself, Eugenie, you know, whose work, it's specific, but then it vibrates, it reverberates, you know, into the larger sort of issues and things that are really important here in our country, and not necessarily our country, but definitely in our country. And then I think about, your theater, Jubilith, and how, you know, you opened this season with the play about Emmett Till. And I'm like, ooh, you know, Emmett Till and Eugen. Emmett Till and No, like, wow.
Yeah, very, very, very neat. Well, it's really interesting because Shuri's work, there's always a touch of the mystic or the magical, maybe magical realist would be a way of saying it, but there's also always an undercurrent, or in some ways, an overcurrent or a wave of the political. And there is that also in this lingering life. There's always, you know, Shuri is a very politically conscious and politically active citizen of the world. Of this country and also of the world. And I love seeing that those sparks come out in this lingering life as well, because, you know, this is a play about transformation and personal transformation, but really there's also a whole lot of politics involved too, which I think there are so many subtle commentaries made about class, and class especially as it has to do with parent-child relations. There's a bit of commentary about capitalism, and it's there, woven in with this within this tale about karmic transformation and love and struggle, and even within the story, there's an angel character in the play also. But all this it's really ingenious, I just love seeing that come through.
Nice, yeah. And this Lingering Life's core creative team is composed of members of Theater of Eugen's ensemble and associate ensemble, its artistic director, of course, and a list of several first-time collaborators. I wonder if you could speak to that, Jubilith, including the Mississippi-based composer Michael Gardiner, and then I was looking at your co-director. She's doing some really amazing work in Rwanda. I'm like, ooh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, talk about the other members of your creative team. Like, oh, my goodness, Eugenie, you all are just, like, doing it. My goodness.
I know. This is it's the biggest project I've ever done. And when you take on something this large, you really want, you know, a warm band of fellows to take the journey with you. And it's been great because so many of the people who are in the acting ensemble I've been working with for a long time. So we have a shorthand, we have a way of working. And there are also some new people that I haven't had the pleasure of working with before in the acting ensemble. There's two young apprentices, Hannah Lennett and Alexander Leiden. The designers are all new to me. Michiko Usugi, who is the set designer, I've admired her work for years and have promised myself at one point I want to be able to work with her. And Tali Floor is, everyone knows her around the Bay Area. Her work is so beautiful. And Alan Wilner is doing the lighting design, and he's, you know, we've been in the same circle for so many years, and we've longed to work with each other, and finally we have the project, the right project to do it. And then I brought in Michael Gardiner for this project, and that was just pure instinct, and I'm so, I cannot express how grateful I am to have him on this journey. He is, he's a genius. He's a musical genius. He's a theorist, and I know him actually through the world of No. He became a student of No, about 10 years ago, and really started studying the music, and is a very accomplished and beautiful flute player, the No-Con flute. And I had the opportunity to see a performance that he composed the music for in New York, oh, I don't know, I'm going to say 8 years ago. And I just thought it was incredible what he was able to do. He works with electronic music, but it's just so rich. There's so much going on. And his understanding of No and his innovating with No and his understanding of the principles and the music of No was what was so exciting to me. And I said, he has this bedrock of knowledge in No, and he is a contemporary musician. And in many ways, I feel like Chiori's play is a beautiful sampling of No, where she, like a really good sampler, like a music sampler, has taken and culled the best parts of these No plays, and then she creates riffs of her own. And Michael is a similarly gifted artist in the musical realm. And so I just thought I need to bring this play and this composer together to do the sound design. And Emily has, she's the assistant director. I've never had the wonderful opportunity to work with an assistant director, and I just needed to bring her into the play. One, she's just a beautiful person. She's just wonderful to have in the room. But she, interestingly, she is incredible with text. She understands text. She knows how to read a text-based play far better than I do. Because my training really is as a performer and is from the No perspective, we think of text completely differently. We relate to text in a very, non-literary or non-Western way. And so I really felt I needed somebody in the room with the actors to kind of call and tease out the best parts of Chiori's very fine script. I needed somebody who had a really fine sense of language, and Emily is bringing that into the production just beautifully. And this might be her San Francisco debut, in some way.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time.
Sorry.
Our next guest is in the studio. No, this is going to be really exciting, this Lingering Lives world premiere at the Theater of Yugen. So I want to let our audience know again that it opens June 5th. It continues through the 14th, so you have like 2 weeks. The previews are at the beginning, you know, June 5th, of course, and, you know, there's a little discount in pricing. opening night is the next evening, and the play continues Wednesday and Thursday at 7 and Friday and Saturday at 8, and then Sunday there's a 2 o'clock matinee. And what's really exciting is that the playwright is going to be available with Eugenie, the dramaturge, for a conversation, and then there's going to also be a conversation with Jubilith Moore, artistic director, on an earlier evening. And so that should be really fun. And all this is taking place at Z-Space, 450 Florida Street at 17th Street in San Francisco. Tickets are $15 to $50, and previews are $15, and opening night is $45. And you can find all that at the website, theaterofyugen.org, and theater is T-H-E-A-T-R-E, and then of Yugen, Y-U-G-E-N. And you can call 415-626-0453. And I want to thank both of you, Jubilith and Eugenie, so much for joining us today. It's been really a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to seeing this magnificent work early next month.
Thank you. Really lovely. It's a great way to start my Friday.
Yeah, and safe travels to both of you, Jubilith, and the playwright when you come back this way, Shiori.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
All right,
thank you so much, Wanda.
You're welcome. Have a great rest of your Friday.
Okay.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Peace and blessings. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, good morning, Dana. How are you?
Good morning. Good.
Glad to have you. Thanks so much for hanging in there.
Thank you. I hope you can hear me well because I'm kind of in between things. So hopefully, okay.
Yeah, I'll let you know if I can't hear you, but so far, so good.
Okay.
Wow, what a magnificent film, Breast Milk. Wow, and it's opening today. Congratulations.
Thank you. Happy to be in San Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah, it's opening at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco and the New Parkway in Oakland. So are you going to be able to make it to both of the theaters this weekend for the screenings?
I am going to be in San Francisco at the Roxy tonight, and I will be there tomorrow for 2 daytime screenings. I'm not making it out to the Oakland Theater.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me tell our audience a little bit about you, and then we can talk about this great film. So Dana Ben-Ari, director and producer, became fascinated with breastfeeding after the birth of her first child. She quickly learned about the physical challenges of motherhood and the problems women encounter after a second child, and she began to examine breastfeeding on film, talking to scores of women. The result is her groundbreaking documentary, Breast Milk, which marks her feature film debut. Ben-Ari was previously a high school teacher in the New York City public schools for 7 years before studying social work, then turning to filmmaking. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and 2 sons. So talk to us about this wonderful film. I have 2 daughters that are grown, and I nursed them, and I really don't remember having so much difficulty. But then, as one of your subjects said, the woman who teaches, I believe at a university, teaches geology, she was saying that sort of the thinking around breastfeeding has shifted and changed, you know, over the years. You know, first, you know, women were encouraged to bottle feed because then that would free them up. and then they were encouraged to breastfeed because then it was more natural and closer, you know, you could bond more with your child and you know, the child would end up, you know, being a more healthy person because of that early bonding and I guess these particular children wouldn't end up taking you, you know, and having you on television and talking about how bad you were as a parent later on and
right.
responsible for all of their problems. So, yeah, just talk about sort of this wonderful journey and how long, you know, sort of the trajectory of the film, like how long did it take you to make it? It seems when you're in the film, you know, as a viewer, it just feels like, you know, you're just so enveloped with these various stories, you don't feel time's passage. But obviously it is because the children are getting older, because you talk to the mother
right.
before and then during and then later on.
Right.
And just talk
right.
a little bit about the work. It's really beautiful.
Thank you. Well, we took about 4 years to make, but what we did is find new mothers who wanted to breastfeed. We spoke to them while they were still pregnant, and this was first time because we wanted to experience all of this with them for the first time. And you're right, it's not that difficult always, and some women have a very easy time. But overall, the theme, I suppose, is that women still are not fully supported, and there isn't an infrastructure that supports maternity. There's no long-term maternity leave. The workplace is very difficult. If you're lucky enough, you have a private room and you have colleagues who are supportive. The medical establishment still, tries to get women in and out of hospitals very quickly, and breastfeeding actually requires everybody to slow down, the mother, the child, people around her. So there still isn't that support to make it much more easy and something that can be maintained. So while many women try to breastfeed in the early moments and days and even weeks, they don't necessarily continue to do so. And we wanted to show that. We wanted to voice these stories because I think it's a very important story to tell. And while we filmed the women for about a year, then we had to edit and think about, you know, festivals. And so it took us about four years to get to this point. We're very excited. And we felt like by the end of the year, we already saw who was going to continue to breastfeed and who wasn't. Actually, even earlier than that, you'll see some of the mothers drop breastfeeding. One mother, a WIC recipient, stops breastfeeding very early on. Another one introduces formula at about 5 months. Another one even earlier. Some of them still breastfed for comfort on and off, but it wasn't an exclusive, you know, experience. And the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends at least 6 months of exclusive breastfeeding, and many women are not making it to that point. The film wants begs to question why. You know, there are a lot of questions in this film. Maybe some of them are not answered. Some of them are left up to the viewer to think about.
Yeah, definitely. And I really love the, the experts. You bring in some really, really fine scholars to sort of just, you know, the women are experiencing what they're experiencing, and then you just bring in this scholar who sort of gives it a social perspective. It's like, well,
right.
You know, the mother would be a lot more successful if, you know. I mean, the hospitals, you know, these various medical situations are, you know, pushing the pump and pushing the formula.
Right.
I mean, like, if you have the formula there to lean on, if you have
right.
a little difficulty, then you're going to open that can or open that
right.
bottle or twist that top. And it's like, you know, it's just yeah, that was, you know, the way you interjected those were really quite, you know, it was well done. And then the actual cinematography was so beautiful. Are you the person that did the camera work?
No, I'm not. I had a great cinematographer, Jay Clinnell.
Mm-hmm.
He did a wonderful job. And yeah, he's great. So we wanted to make it as beautiful as possible as well, because the other goal, I mean, one is to kind of question why women are having such a hard time and to show them and their stories. And the other is also to make this a visible, beautiful experience, because I feel like many women don't get to see what it looks like and what it is until they're in that situation. And that, too, is part of the, you know, maybe ignorance is a strong word, but maybe not. It's just part of what makes it tricky, is that we're not really seeing it until we have to go through it ourselves. And if we see it more and are around it more, it will just be part of our reality. It will be easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really liked Ileana's, you know, sort of dilemma, like, okay, who do my breasts belong
yeah.
to? They belong to me? I mean, to my husband, or
right.
do they belong to my baby? Yes. Sort of like sort of parceling out her body parts and then sort of being really conflicted. And then it's really interesting, the young woman who ends up, you know, giving a lot of reasons why using not breastfeeding works out best. That's Crystal.
Right.
Because early on, you know, when they're in the hospital still, because she ended up having to have a C-section,
mm-hmm.
she wants to breastfeed, but her husband, her child's father, really, he just doesn't want her. He's not supporting that because
right.
the whole thing is it takes too long. It's like, you know,
right.
give the kid a bottle, it's like so much faster.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's true. And the fathers are not always so helpful. And even though they mean well, they might not necessarily understand what their role is and how they can help. And sometimes their help is more to be hands-off, you know. Maybe their help is more to just take care of the mother, not so much to feed the baby. And it's true, Ileana has this dilemma, and it's a very typical woman's dilemma of our bodies and how our bodies are really, they've always throughout history, women have been peacemakers in one way or another, and this is another example of, like, who does my body belong to, and when is it mine, when is it my child, when is it for my partner, and it's complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you have this lovely couple, Sam and Lara. Really like them. They spend a lot of time sitting on their bed with a lovely tapestry of the nude woman behind
yeah.
them.
Yeah,
that's really, that, really great.
Yeah, that's their bedroom. It was just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the way it is. Yeah, and they also chime in about the father's role, the mother's role.
Mm-hmm.
What is a traditional household versus a more progressive, and even within progressive households, you'd see that couples sort of divide and conquer when it makes sense, and sometimes it does have to do with something more traditional, like the mother is feeding the child, the father is working longer hours,
mm-hmm.
and everyone has to figure out what works for them. I mean, the ideal scenario is that for every family and every couple to have freedom to be able to make those decisions to the best they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you know, we already mentioned the mother, Colleen. I mean, she is. It's just such a sad story. You know, she really wants to breastfeed her child, and
yeah.
it's just not working out. You know, for whatever reasons, and. And it seems, I mean, even after the film ends, it seems like it's going to take a while for her to sort of come to grips with that. You know, she
right.
can still be a good mother even if you're not the
right.
primary, you know, nutrition supplier. Because one woman
right.
said, who was that, was that Karen?
Yeah,
I think it was Karen. Yeah, she was saying how it was so cool to be able to, like, she looked at the milk in the bottle, and she's like, wow, I made this. This is
right.
like I'm providing nutrition, not Safeway for my
right. child.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. What is it all about at the end?
Mm-hmm.
And it's complicated,
right.
though, because while the women feel bad about themselves, you know, they would be more comfortable with themselves and, I think, feel less anxiety if there was just more support from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we tend to, in our culture, to blame the women for then feeling bad, which is just wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, sort of themes of, you know, like one woman is asked when, you know, someone sees her breastfeeding and I guess the child is maybe one or something, oh, you must really like that. And she's like, I'm feeding my child. Like, what's with you? And then, and then there's the husband who says, oh, I just wasn't raised around seeing women nursing, and it just embarrasses me. And I'm sure it's projecting. I'm sure it's embarrassing other people to see you. And then the wife says, well, you know, like we're all sitting here eating at the restaurant, and the baby's just eating. And he's like, he is so not feeling that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering, and then I really love when one of your, I think it's Karen again, raises the whole thing around economics. You know, the hospitals pushing, because when I was nursing my children, this was like 30 years ago now, my older daughter, I don't remember. I mean, I remember seeing breast pumps, and the Little Leachy League has been around. It was around then, too, and I got those pamphlets when I was at the hospital. And I know they were there for support, but I didn't actually need them. I think I just called them. I remember no one actually talked in the film. No one talks about how it hurts. You know, like you have your breasts starts to get kind of tough. No one talks about how, you know, though the initial when the baby clamps down, it's like, oh, my God, I felt like taking an Advil. But they didn't have Advil back then. I think it would have been aspirin. It's like it hurts so much. But then, you know that eventually it's going to get, you know, your body's going to, your breast is going to get used to it, and it's going to get tougher so they won't hurt as much. But I know initially it's like, okay, I just had to sort of just breathe through it. But some things really have changed. And I was just wondering if you can talk about sort of your experience with breastfeeding your children and the experiences of these various women that you came to meet in the course of these 3 years and the film.
Right. Well, I think that their experience is very realistic, and I find that, you know, so many women go through some version of this. I mean, the tongue tie is something that I think now is sort of maybe 1 out of 4 women experience. Not everybody decides to go ahead and do the tongue tie relief, but it is much more common than we realize, but it's harder to detect. And then the low supply is something that's discussed in the film, which many women are feeling, but could just be something to do with managing time, managing the workplace, slowing down, and also that insistence of pumping right away at the hospital, it doesn't help. So these are very common experiences, and I think that's why we ended up choosing sort of the most common ones, because we wanted people to relate to them and not feel like they can just dismiss it as some extreme example of something, you know, in the way sometimes people can dismiss. Someone asked me in another interview, well, you don't have like a 7-year-old breastfeeding or something like that. And I feel like while some of those families do choose to breastfeed that long, for most women, that's not the reality. Most women are having a hard time making it to 3 months plus. And if they're lucky, they're doing it 6 months and then continuing on for as long as they want. But I wanted to kind of really keep this sort of middle ground so we could say, like, this is the reality for many, many women, not just a few.
And what I liked also about the film was that the women who had more community, not just their partner, but community of other nursing women, they seemed to have more success with nursing than those that were like the only one in the family that wanted it to happen. Like, you know, like we go back to Crystal, she really wanted to nurse, and even in the hospital you showed how they were like taking the baby from her. I'm like, oh, that's so wrong. I mean, they were not supporting her around her choice of nursing. And then we have Lindsay, you know, she's a single mother raising her child without the father. And she, like, has the baby in her office, and just, like, she's just loving it, and the baby.
Right.
And, oh, and you have some beautiful baby pictures, like the baby smiling. I mean, you know, and the baby sleeping and smiling. Oh, you have some really wonderful ones like that. And I love the milk symphony where the milk is just squirting. That is so pretty. That particular
Right, thank you.
Scene. Yeah.
Yeah, that's that was just another beautiful moment to celebrate women and our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also kind of balances a little bit of the struggle, too, because there is a lot of struggle in the film. But I wanted to also show the happy moments. And, you know, that's just a visual reminder of this can happen, and it does happen. You know, so we don't have so many... The main women that we follow do have these challenges, and they are kind of down. But I wanted to also include these other moments that are clearly up.
Yeah, and I love the two same sex couples, the men
yeah.
who have a baby and the women who have a baby, and particularly the women, because one of them is coming from a non-American perspective and saying that this whole thing about not having enough milk and all that kind of stuff, like, you have enough, you know, if you
right.
just go with it. And how, you know, sort of women have been socialized, you know, coming out of, I guess, this medical paradigm to not wait and not
right.
I guess, not believe that their bodies are capable. And your experts talk about that, too, about sort of the
right.
criminalizing of the women's bodies and making the women feel like they can't
right.
do what they you know, like, oh, you're not a woman because you can't produce. And
right.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I think that that's a real challenge, to get women to be more comfortable with their bodies, and that's something that has to start from the beginning. And
mm-hmm.
I think this is a conversation also to have with teenagers and young adults. This is not something that we should, you know, only talk about when we're having babies. I think that women of all different generations should always be talking about everything. as soon as there's a conversation, it's very important for older generations to include younger generations, because that's really the only way, I think, to encourage this sort of body literacy and knowledge and belief that we are good enough and this can happen and it will happen. And that's why I really enjoy having older women come to a screening, and I've had a couple already come to me after a Q&A and tell me that they're postmenopausal, they never had kids, and they really enjoy the film. This is a film for all women and for people who have women in their lives, which is really most of us in one way or another. We have a woman in our life, and to encourage women to really be more kind of grounded in themselves and believe in themselves, and then of course to also be assertive and outspoken regarding their needs, which is very hard to do, I think. Some women just have that naturally, but many don't, especially in these vulnerable moments. But if we can create a culture that supports that, even, you know, regardless of maternity, then, you know, then it would also affect these moments when we are with our babies. You know what I mean? It's just about creating a culture that's just more supportive of women in general and of girls.
Yes, certainly. And I going back to the same-sex couples and just sort of thinking about the whole idea that, you know, men, I've heard of lactating men. I don't know if they have produce enough milk to be able to take care
right.
of an infant. But I know that men can lactate. But in this particular couple, neither one of them did that. But they did come into a community where women who had excess milk shared it with them. And I just love, Lindsay, the mother who had like a whole freezer full of milk?
Because she just to be adoptive
yeah.
parents. Yeah, yeah,
right,
that's
right.
Right.
That was so
well,
sweet.
That's also
yeah.
The, yeah. Well, that brings up the question of when we do need help with supply and with supplementing. Why do we go to formula? Why do we not go to our friends and family
mm-hmm.
the way people used to? So that brings
right,
that
right.
question up. I mean, mm-hmm. if you had a sister who had extra milk, or a friend you trusted, or even somebody in your community, then why is that not sufficient or better than formula. That's that question, you know. And for some people it is, and for some people they don't feel comfortable with that. But again, this film is meant to raise all of these questions and make us think about it rather than necessarily tell people what to do. We're not prescribing something, right? We're just opening it up.
Yeah, you open it up. You open it up very well. I mean, very, very well. I mean, there's so many conversations that you open and don't tie off, which is just like the conversations go on and on and on, which is really wonderful because, you know, you think about the whole notion of the wet nurse. And Ileana, you know, she shows a mother how to nurse her baby, you know, by actually nursing the baby and showing her how to hold the baby, how to, you know, how to, you know, when the baby's finished, how to take the baby off the breast. You know, I mean, it's how better can you do it is actually demonstrated. And,
exactly.
I mean,
and when women are,
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, when women are given a chance to help one another, they do so so beautifully, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
certainly.
Well, that moment is so perfect. Women just can help one another when they're given that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great example that you gave. And also Lindsay, who donates her milk and then talks about race and will they use her milk, and that comes up. And so if you do know the history of wet nursing, that's interesting too, right? Because would that have mattered? And so in that scene, you kind of get a little touch of that moment of, you know, when we had wet nursing and slavery, and as we know, so many African-American women gave their milk. So, I mean, they had to. And in that moment with Lindsay, you're kind of reminded of it, and here she is, contemporary time, thinking about that. What would happen? Would they really use it? So I love those natural moments when the women reveal, right, their most inner kind of thoughts and concerns, conflicts. It's so telling, so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my next guest is in the studio. So in closing, I wanted to ask you, because, you know, one doesn't necessarily think about the politics of milk, but that certainly comes to mind, the politics of breastfeeding. It's like, wow, you know, 21st century, like, wow, this is a political act. You know, these women, these brave women who nurse their children and, you know, do something so natural, which is, you know, quote, for some people see as not civilized. Like, you don't have to do that because, you know, we're in the 21st century. You don't have to nurse your baby. Go buy the milk somewhere.
Yeah,
I was wondering if you could talk about your, also within that, talk about your creative team, your producers, and then lastly, all these great scholars that you have, supporting these various strands of query that these women bring up and are experiencing as we watch the film.
Okay, so we have Fiona Giles, who's from Australia. She has a wonderful book out called Fresh Milk, and she's written other essays and books about the subject. And I just think she is very brave and courageous to to remind us of how puritanical our society is and how we're still stuck in this dilemma, this sort of, you know, mother-wife, or as she says, mother-whore dilemma, and that our body, women's bodies, still kind of create this tension and are sort of split in our culture. And it would be so much easier for all of us if we can just, you know, combine all of our different roles into one, which is what we are, what each woman really represents. And then we have Dr. Jack Newman, who's from Canada, has a wonderful breastfeeding clinic. He does great work training consultants and physicians and women to help, with breastfeeding questions and problems. And he's really great. I love that the film actually shows him in a slightly different light. You know, it's a little bit more with humor. and then we have Bernice Hausman, who is a professor at Virginia Tech, and she is also a very, very strong thinker and writer around this issue, and she has two great books. One of them is called Mother's Milk, and she's got many, but on this issue, Mother's Milk, and the other one is Viral Mothers, which actually explores the debate about women with HIV and nursing. It's also fascinating. It's a whole other issue. But she does a great job breaking down the pros and cons of all sides. And then there's Patrice, who's a community health worker who works for WIC, or at the time worked for WIC, and really tries to counsel young women to breastfeed and help them through those first few months and beyond. So we have we had a great variety of voices, which I think is wonderful, because ultimately I do see this as a feminist film, and in some ways, you know, if I could call it feminine, whatever that means, you know, maybe that's a little bit complicated to pinpoint, but, you know, the fact that it is focusing on the stories and not on the statistics, that it really is about the personal being political, is where I think we succeeded. And then we have Jake Linnell, the cinematographer, who did a wonderful job, two great editors, and then Ricky and Abby, who came on board after everything was done, because they love the movie and they really wanted to help me bring it to a wider audience. So their role is more on the promotional side right now as executive producers. And they've been great, very supportive throughout this final phase in bringing the film to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, with Ricky Lake, you know, the business being born, I mean, it's just sort of... And it's just sort of right in line with, you know, with the theme of your work. And then
right.
Your best birth, you know, the book that
right.
that Lake and Abby Epstein produced, came out together with. So it's, you know, thematically, it wasn't intuitive that, okay, you know, when they found out about your film, that they wouldn't want to be part of it, getting it
of
out
course.
There. And
of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is an extension of childbirth, and that's part of why there is such a challenge, I think, because this is an extension of maternity and reproductive rights that we have sort of just dismissed as a culture. And that's why we only have those 6 weeks through FMLA, because that's what the health insurance recognizes as 6 weeks time for a medical procedure, you know? And we have a woman and a baby who need to be together for a lot longer than 6 weeks. Of course, if women choose to go to work full-time right after the baby is born, that's fine, too. That's their decision. But the problem we have is that we really don't have the support for the women who want to stay at home and be closer to their babies, or have a workplace that's more flexible where they can bring their babies, or, you know, all sorts of scenarios that women who have more resources can creatively work around, but most of us don't.
Right.
So that's what makes it a political film, and that's where legislation has to come in. And I think that it's a long time from now when we can see sort of the utopia that would be ideal, or at least better than we are now, but it's still an important conversation to have so we can take those steps and get there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Dana, to talk about Breast Milk, which is opening tonight, today, actually, at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco, and you're going to be present at the screenings there.
Yes, and I'll be there at 8:30 for the Q&A.
Okay, excellent, 8:30 this evening. And then at the New Parkway is also opening in Oakland, but you're not going to be at that screening. So people are kind of like, oh, which side of the bay do I want to see the film in? So if they want to see you, they have to go to San Francisco.
Now you can still chat on an email to me, and I'm on all, you know, social media outlets, and I'm still here. I'm still around.
All right, cool.
Stay connected. Thank you so much. Right. You've been wonderful.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. And good luck on your film's distribution.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take good care. Bye-bye. Good morning, Lorenda. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for your flexibility. I mean, I was taking you all over the place in those emails with regards to times. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. I'm doing just fine. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm well. I'm well. We're speaking to Lorinda D. Brown, who's a playwright, and she has taken one of her, I believe, a novel, Walk Like a Man, if I was reading it correctly, and written a play based on that particular book, and it's going to be, it's not as a world premiere, but this is the first time, I believe, that it's been to San Francisco. Is that correct, that Walk Like a Man has been produced? Is that first time here in Northern California?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Okay, excellent, excellent. So it's going to be at Theater Rhinoceros in San Francisco, and it's going to be opening next week, May 28th, and it's going to be continuing for a nice long length of time through June 15th, 3 weeks, Wednesday through Saturday, 8 o'clock, and Sundays at 3. Are you going to be able to come out for the opening?
I won't be there for the opening. I've been asked to come for the talkback, which is on June 1st. At 5 o'clock.
Nice.
After. Yes, so I had planned to be at the premiere, but I was only going to stay for the evening. And it's probably a lot easier for me to just come and stay for a couple of days and do the Q&A.
Okay, nice, nice. Well, let me tell our audience a little about you. Let's see, you use your writing to tell universal stories that apply to all cross-sections of society. You're a graduate of Howard University, and you write about life, not lifestyles. You currently reside. So I heard that you just bought a house, or maybe you bought a house in Mississippi. Are you in Mississippi now?
I'm in Mississippi now. I actually got married 3 years ago.
Congratulations.
So,
oh, nice.
Yes. Moved here where my wife is.
Okay. Yeah, what part of Mississippi? I have family in Mississippi, in the southern part.
It's called Prentice, Mississippi. It's about 50 miles south of Jackson. And maybe 45 minutes east-west of Hattiesburg.
Okay, yeah. What a pretty town name, Princess.
Well, trust me, you know, it leaves a lot to be desired, but it's home, so I've made the best of it over the past 3 years, and I actually think it's probably one of the best decisions I've made in my entire life, just for the peace, you know, quiet here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's given me an opportunity to just really come from, you know, the madness and chaos for me in Atlanta, and then, but there, you know, we have one traffic light. You know, there's one grocery store, and right. Post office closes at noon on Thursdays, and so does the rest of the town because the post office is closed. So I needed that piece so I could get back to writing, and it's been a godsend, trust me.
Nice, nice. Wow, yeah. So are your two daughters, are they with you, or are they grown?
Ironically, on this day, they're both home. But they are both college students. One attends Dillard University in New Orleans, and the other one attends Howard. She's going into her junior year at Howard.
Oh, nice. Yeah, her mom's alma mater. Nice, nice.
Yeah, her mom and her dad. But she didn't apply anywhere. She applied to Stanford, but I think her first choice was Howard the whole time.
Oh, nice, nice, nice. Are either one of them writers, your daughters?
Both of them are exquisite writers. I envy my older daughter because she is so, her words are just, oh, they're killer. I mean, she is extremely gifted with that. But my other daughter is more of a urban writer, and I probably see her doing something more, you know, BET or, you know, something. Her major is urban policy. Urban studies and public policy, and her minor is public relations. So somewhere in there, she's going to fit that writing in, but they're both extremely gifted when it comes to writing.
Nice, nice, yeah. And your best-selling books published by Simon & Schuster include Walk Like a Man, which you've adapted for the stage, and it was a Lambda Award winner, Undercover, Fire, and Brimstone, and The Highest Price for Passion. Your Walk Like a Man, you adapted that. When did you adapt that, actually? Because it's been performed in numerous United States cities.
The book was actually self-published at first, and then it was by Cubero Books, which was at some point bought by Urban Books, which is at one time it was being distributed through Kensington. So Walk Like a Man wasn't through Simon & Schuster, but I adapted the play in 2006.
Okay.
In the spring of 2006, and we opened actually 8 years ago this weekend. I can't even think about, you know, I'm so far removed from stuff. I'm like, you know, this is, you know, Memorial Day weekend. So, yeah, we opened D.C. Black Pride Weekend in 2006.
Wow. That's your play has had quite a life, 2006 to 2014. So what brings it to San Francisco? How did Theater Rhinoceros find out about your work?
To this day, I can never tell you how they found out. I received an email, a message on Facebook, and actually it went through my fan page, which is going to sound really crazy. I had no idea how the fan page got there because I didn't do it. But I never checked the messages. And so when it was revealed to me who started the page, it was actually a fan that started the fan page, and she turned the page over to me. I had a message from him. And the first time he contacted me, it's been a while ago. This has been kind of in the works, well over a year. Well, probably close to 2 years, because I told him I was really just not necessarily not interested at the time. My life was just crazy, and I really didn't understand what was being asked of me, because no one's ever come to me with that before. So John Fisher, he and I started a conversation, and he asked me, he said he wanted to produce the show. And given that I've always produced it and, you know, done everything, I didn't really know what that entailed. And pretty much, you know, he explained to me that all they needed is a script and everything else wasn't on them. I'm like, hey, take it, whatever you want to do. So it was a blessing. And, you know, we had been trying to get to the Bay Area for some years. And, you know, I travel with the same folks, and, you know, people did not realize that, you know, 10 to 15 people, you know, that was expensive for me to foot the bill. And we just never were able to get it together. And so when he approached me, I felt there was a tremendous opportunity to be able to get it out there finally.
Yeah. From what I read about Walk Like a Man, sounds like a different vignettes, different stories. And I was wondering if you could, tell us about the story. What is Walk Like a Man about? And
Well, actually, Walk Like a Man is a series. It's a book of short stories.
Okay.
And people were kind of shocked that I wrote all of them, because most of them have different voices. And when I envisioned putting it on stage, I really just kind of wanted to see what these characters would look like. And, you know, it was never anything planned out. I didn't know anything about theater. My major is English. I don't care about theater. I wasn't trained in theater. So it was important to me to be able to see these voices, because I started getting a lot of emails and messages regarding the work. And just one day I held a casting call and people came. I hired them, and 6 weeks later we had a show. The title itself came from a situation I found myself in, where I met a young lady who was rather feminine, you know, very, you know, prissy, well-dressed or what have you. But whenever she entered the room, she had the swagger of a man. And I was on stage at a book signing, and she walked in, and I looked at her as she walked through the door, and she just had this, you know, I own the room type feel. So that's where the title came from. And then most of the scenarios came from, you know, things I either experienced or I heard other people experience. And some of them were just, you know, my crazy imagination going in overdrive. So I didn't expect, you know, it to ever get to this point. You know, I was just playing around. I really was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, it must really resonate for audiences since, you know, your play was first staged, let's see, 8 years ago? That's long.
8 years ago.
That's long. Yeah, yeah. 8 years ago to this weekend. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I tried to put it to bed, you know, or retire it, as they say. You know, someone would ask me, when you're going to bring it here, when you're going to bring it there. And, you know, we played Atlanta a number of times. We played Washington, D.C. a number of times. And even today, there's still people asking, when you're going to bring it to Atlanta, when you're going to bring it to D.C. And so I got tired, you know, and I started aging. And so all the coming and going that we were doing, I mean, we would literally, you know, leave for a show on Thursday, do the show on Friday, on Saturday. And sometimes we would leave on Friday and do the show on Saturday, drive back on Sunday, arrive back wherever we were living, you know, on that Monday morning, wash our clothes, get everything ready for the next city and be out the door again on that Thursday or that Friday. And this was like this for, you know, a couple of years. And the messages were so incredible for some people. Some of the scenes were, you know, will take you places where you thought you had forgotten about them, where you wanted to forget, but, you know, you get this reminder in this play. We've had people to ask me to have some type of social worker outside because some of the scenes are so heavy, you know, emotionally. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to, you know, line the vignettes and the monologues in such a way that it gives you kind of like a, on one end of the spectrum, you're crying, you're mad, on the other end, you're laughing, so you know, pretty much fall out of your seat. So we had to try to balance the humor with the serious stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us about, you know, some of your characters that you've developed that, you know, resonate so strongly with audiences.
Okay, I'll tell you about some of them because I don't want to give away. The play itself is comprised of maybe 21 or 22 scenes, and what we've often done is just pull from those scenes and created a lineup, depending on where we were. You know, some cities probably would not react well to certain topics, so we would not do it in those cities. But then, like I said, you know, D.C. and Atlanta, everything goes. You know, so we have a character, probably my favorite character is Mo. The scene itself is called Monique, and I wrote it at first as a healing mechanism for myself, being a victim of child sexual abuse. And I've only had really had two actresses, maybe three, to play that role. But two of them just really, they owned it. Every time we did the show, they knew that that's what they were going to be doing. And these were like, you know, very, they were masculine presenting women. And I saw them break down, you know, in rehearsals. And they would never really tell me what was wrong. But when we had an opportunity to be behind closed doors or kind of be amongst ourselves, that's when it would come out that at some point they had either been raped or experienced some type of sexual abuse, you know, during their lives. And being in that character allowed them to heal. It made them win. They became the winner, you know, in that scene. And so I think it's probably my favorite character, simply because I've literally had people walk up to me. One girl in particular, her name was Monique, and she had changed her name to Mo because of what had happened to her. And I did not at any point think that the play would be therapeutic like that for someone. We have a scene called Tastes Like Chicken, where a bi-curious woman seduces her best friend, who is gay. But it's told from the standpoint of the woman that's supposedly straight. A lot of humor, extremely, extremely, extremely steamy. It puts you in a position, you ask yourself, has this ever happened to me? We deal with, you know, same-sex attraction in the workplace. We deal with domestic violence. We deal with two male presenting or two stud women in a relationship in a scene called Dom and Dahmer. And we deal with a couple of legal issues that have some twists in them. I'm not really going to put those out there because they totally blindside you. But we touch on a variety of issues, and they're real. They're not. It's not something that's just made up. You know what I'm saying? It's something that everybody can relate to.
Nice. So talk about your writing life. You mentioned how in your current, you know, where you live presently in Mississippi, it has been an opportunity for you to be still. And so I was wondering, if that's an element that makes it easier for you to be creative as a writer. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your writing life, and particularly about these stories. How long did it take you to write, you know, these stories about these women that reflect the lives of many of your audience, which seem to be really devoted to the work?
Well, Walk Like a Man was quick. I mean, I got it out. I did it probably in less than a month. And It started out as like only 10 stories. And then when it was picked up by the publisher, you know, he asked me to add some more stories, and I did. You know, for me, writing is like breathing. I can write about everything I see and everybody I meet. But I can't do it just, you know, glued to a desk or glued to my office or out and about. And, you know, prior to me moving here, I lived in Atlanta for almost six years, and it was not the best place. And contrary to what it might seem as far as the atmosphere and the climate, from a personal perspective, it just was not the best place I've ever lived. And I experienced a lot of hardships that really opened my eyes to life. I grayed probably in the course of the first three months I lived in Atlanta. My hair started turning gray. And, yeah, people that had seen me, you know, that knew me before I moved to Atlanta, you know, they saw me maybe 3 or 4 months into that move. You know, I went back to Virginia to visit, and they were like, what's going on up here? What's going on with your hair? And I'm like, I don't know. You know, life was not kind to me in Atlanta. I met some nice people, but I can count on one hand how many there were. But everything else was just hell. I'm just going to be honest. So I couldn't write. I wrote two of my last two books were written there. And to me, they sucked. I didn't put a whole lot of energy into them. Even though I had a storyline for months prior to me moving there, I never could open up. I felt stifled. And so now that I'm in a different environment, I put it out in the universe that I wanted to be in a place where I only had a two-bedroom, two-bath house where I could stand out front, you know, see the front porch, you know, and the back porch stand in the same spot in the house. And I didn't want to have any internet service because I feel somewhat intimidated at times by what I see on Facebook and I really finally got to a point over the past couple of months where I believe people are not so truthful about what they post in social media. I didn't want the internet. I didn't want my phone to work. I didn't want to be bothered. And I felt like I needed to come back to what really got me interested in writing in the first place. To me, it's like I have Lorinda Brown is my professional person, the person I go do the 9-to-5 for the man, you know, collect that paycheck every month. But then there's Lorinda Diane Brown, who I was born. That's the name my family gave me. But then there's Lorinda D. Brown, this writer that has emerged from those two people. So I had to learn how to allow all three of them to exist at the same time. And so being out here, I've been able to really get to a place of peace. Those people that I kept close to me at one time, they're not close to me anymore. It's by choice. No one's mad with one another. There are no issues. I just prefer to be quiet. And what it has allowed me to do is to focus more on my inner self, more on my spiritual self. And, I mean, honestly, there are times I would look at Walk Like a Man or read through it and just be like, wow, I wrote this. And I would get turned off by it because it was written at a time where I was so, where my life was just so chaotic. And to me, it feels like it's a lot of energy. So now, you know, my head is literally overloaded with information. And I've created a space for me where I systematically put things down, you know, on paper. And that's rare for me because I don't write things down. I feel like that's only exposing somebody to your thoughts. Keep it to yourself until you're ready to put it, you know, in a manuscript form, and that's what I do. So everything has to have order. You know, I have to go clean my garage first before I start writing. I have to clean my office before I write. Everything in the kitchen's got to be in order. And that's where I am right now. So for those people that have been waiting for my next book, it's close. You know, I just had to clean house. And it's a good space for me, you know, a really good space for me.
Yeah, yeah. Can you talk about what you're working on now? Is it really different from other work?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's different. I've never, and I hope that people understand when I say this, I've never come out the gate wanting to be a lesbian writer, and that was not why I started writing. What I was able to do was able to infuse the LGBT lifestyle into real life without people being turned off by it. Fire and Brimstone was really harsh. I mean, me as a young writer didn't really know what to do. I wrote what I felt. And if I could do it over again, I would. But it's probably one of the few books that I still get royalties off of. And it's been out over 10 years. So this project is called Married Black Female. It actually should have been released 4 years ago. And, you know, we often talk about, you know, African-American men on the down low, but in this instance it's the women that are on the down low. And a good portion of them in these stories, they're married. And I'll tell you that, you know, the woman, the lesbian doesn't always get the girl. And it's not one of those where you're trying to convert somebody to believe a certain thing. It's showing you life, you know, and how we react to people. You know, sometimes it's been my experience. I'm not going to say it was me, but it's been my experience that, you know, sometimes straight women come to us with a homophobic attitude, but you don't understand why you have it. You know, you have this prejudice against, you know, gay, African-American, you know, lesbians, but you don't know why. You know, we have no, what's the word to it? We're not there to hurt you. We don't want you. We don't want every woman. But in this story, it explains how we're all human and how some of us have no control over our emotions. you know, there's nothing wrong with you telling your best girlfriend that she's beautiful, that she looks good, that she's built like, you know, a brick house without having any type of sexual connotations behind it. And so my writing has always been important for me to express how I see other people and how they react. And I'm not just going to come directly out and say, you know, I'm going to write this character. Her name is Berlin, and she's an automatic lesbian. No. We're not going to make her an automatic lesbian. And in this case, in this book, Berlin is one of the main characters. She is a married woman of almost 30 years and high-powered woman of almost 30 years, in control of one of the most prestigious cultural events in the country. But on the side, she's got a chick, and the chick is her best friend. And for those 25 of those 30 years, they've been lovers. And so their lives are infused into the lives of maybe five or six other couples. And what I've done, you know, is pull some of the experiences from my own life over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, particularly those times when I was in Atlanta, and put them in this book. And it's probably why I've been so slow with trying to have a finished piece, because every day I want to make sure you understand what I'm saying. I'm not trying to offend you. I was trying to tell you about you, you know, so you can understand how you're seen and how you're observed. And so I think it's going to be something that people are going to want to talk about. I do plan to do a play from it. I'm excited. I'm nervous. And I had this kind of nervousness when I did Walk Like a Man, because I didn't know what to expect. I knew what I was putting on paper when I wrote Walk Like a Man. I cried at the end of every chapter, and I cried because it was like I didn't know where the information was coming from. And I asked God, what are you doing? What are you doing? It was like somebody else was writing, and I never went back and rewrote anything. What came out the first time was what it was, and that's the way it stayed. So that's the way I feel about Married Black Female. And I'm working on that in another book. They both should have come out the same year. And, you know, Simon & Schuster, you know, Straybook Books has been really – Zane has been a doll with, you know, understanding that life had to happen to me first. And there are a couple of things I had pitched in Married Black Female that I had not even – I couldn't even tell you about, you know, Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans and stuff like that, because I had never been to New Orleans, and my plan was to do what I normally would do, Google it and go to Wikipedia, whatever, and create my own background. But now I live 2 hours from New Orleans, and that was the first trip my wife took me on, was to New Orleans. And so my life, I had to live it in order to be able to write about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Married Black Female sounds like it's going to have a similar type of trajectory as Walk Like a Man. Yeah, you seem to be able to create these literary situations that speak to a community that doesn't necessarily have its life articulated in a real non-stereotypical kind of way.
Yeah, it's not. I have to just, you know, tell on you. Put it that way. In the book. You might have made me mad 10 years ago, or you might have done said something at an event 5 years ago, or we may have had a conversation last night. Some kind of way I'm going to take those three times and create a situation. And if you were in it, you know it's, I'm talking about you. But no one else would. Nobody else would.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just thought of Terry McMillan came to mind before you started talking just now, and but you're a little bit more legally and politically sophisticated, because you know, with her book Disappearing Acts, how that got her into trouble legally, because one of the her son's father recognized himself in the book and sued her for some royalties. I think he lost it, but after that lost the case, but after that she made sure that she, because she writes really close to her experience, that she got permission from her girlfriends before she did Waiting to Exhale. I guess she didn't have to ask her mother for mama.
I think the one time I was asked, not really indirectly asked about some of the characters, I just said, are you really, if we go to court about this, go. We can box about it. I don't care. But at the end of the day, are you really going to sit on the witness stand and say you're just trifling? You know what I'm saying? I'm not going to make you look good in the book. I'm not going to write a book for anybody. But if you're going to, if there's some characteristic about yourself, and there's some in Walk Like a Man and some of those people that I did put in there, are you really going to want to go out, be public and tell somebody that you're this low down and that you're this trifling? You want to, it's fine. But realize what you're saying. So nobody's ever complained. And like I said, I just really try to make sure that I don't totally infringe upon somebody's personal life. I just kind of put some twists and turns in there to make sure that the innocent, are shown to be guilty.
Wow, yeah. So I want to let our audience know again that we're speaking to Lorenda D. Brown about her story and her play, Walk Like a Man, which is being produced by Theater Rhinoceros, having its Bay Area premiere. It's going to be really exciting. It's directed by John Fisher, and he's an award-winning director. The Bay Area premiere of the play, Walk Like a Man, is May 28th through June 15th, and Lorenda says that she'll be in town for the talkback on June 1st, which is that next week?
Yes, next Sunday.
Next Sunday, yeah, at 5 p.m. So that's really exciting. So definitely want to try to get into the theater opening weekend, because it's always really wonderful to be able to talk to the writer, the playwright, after you see the work and see it embodied, and I'm sure the fine fashion that this particular cast under John Fisher's direction is going to be able to, sort of breathe, a different kind of spirit into the work. I'm sure you'll be really pleased with it, Lorenda. And for people who are interested in tickets, the previews are May 28th, 29th, and 30th. Opening night is May 31st at 8 p.m. Wednesday, Saturday are 8 p.m., and Sunday is 3 p.m. And you can get tickets at therhino.org, R-H-I-N-O.org, or you can call 1-800-838-3006. And tickets are $15 through $30, so it's pretty affordable. And let me tell you where the theater is located. I'm looking for the address as we Theater Rhinoceros is located at the Costume Shop, and that is at 11-17, Market Street at 7th Street. It's right on the BART run, so you could take BART and get off and walk right over there. Yeah, that should be really exciting. So 1117 Market Street, that's where the play is being staged, and it's a nice intimate space. So you can definitely be right in the play. It's that if you sat on the front row, you feel like you're part of the scene, which is always really fun in those type of venues. Wow, it's been really really lovely speaking to you, Lorenda. And I hope you have safe travels this way, and a belated Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. All righty. Well, I look forward to meeting you when you come to town, and I'm really looking forward to Married Black Female, the book and the play. That's going to really be exciting, and hopefully, be able to talk to you again about that work.
Well, I hope so. This conversation has put another fire under me, so I'll be, stuck in this office this weekend trying to get it done.
All right, cool. You got my details, so definitely have your representatives stay in touch with me and let me know when something's out, and we can have you in and have you back, and hopefully have you come visit us on this coast. That'd be really super.
Well, I put all of it up in prayer, and I've seen it, so So you'll probably see me in a year or two.
All right, excellent. Well, you take good care, and I look forward to meeting you when you come this way.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Okay,
peace and blessings.
Okay, bye-bye.
Is this Sister Khalifa?
Yes, it is, Miss Wanda. How are you?
Oh, I'm excellent, excellent. How are you? You are so busy, like, this weekend. My goodness, like, tonight at the D. Young, you're going to be, like, getting people all in the carnival spirit, and then you got classes that you're teaching, and,
yes,
oh, my goodness.
Yes.
So just tell us, Sister Regina Khalifa, what you got going on.
Well, there's plenty to go on. As you know, that this weekend is the Bay Area Carnival season, and we're in full throttle and full motion. Carnival San Francisco is celebrating 36 years in the Mission District, and, of course, there is the transcendental nature of Oakland Carnival happening again at Mosswood Park, which is being presented by Caribe OmniLink. That's Brother Theo over there with the hot samba funk at the Malunga Coscalor Center for the Arts. And then, of course, with my own self, I am celebrating Khalifa da Bahia 94, a 20-year sojourn of cultivating Brazilian dance and drum traditions in the Bay Area since my first trip to Salvador da Bahia, Brazil. And so I'm teaching classes at the New Web, downtown Oakland at 355 12th Street. And then I am joining a hot Brazilian band called Samba Da to perform at three stages. And tonight is my first performance with Samba Da. That's led by Papiba Godinho and my girl Donna Daora. And this will be at the De Young Museum. They have the Friday nights at the De Young tonight at 6 o'clock, 6:30, and it's free. And that's in San Francisco. So, yep, it's a lot going on, but 'tis the life of a carnivalesca, right?
Definitely, if her name is Khalifa, for sure. not all, but definitely you.
Bless you, thank you. That is so real, thank you.
Yeah, so tell folks a little bit more about the D. Young debut with the band, because it's a free event. So tell
yes,
us a little more
is.
Details about that, so people who want to come down and check you out, you know, can participate. And then you can move on into Saturday, and then you can move
okay.
on into Sunday, and then you can move on
oh,
to
God bless
the Monday
you.
Where, you know, like, and then also tell us again about, you know, how – you know, people can come take your classes every Thursday from 6 to 7:30. I am so going to be in the house, girl. Oh, my goodness.
You are so a welcome guest. You know that wherever I'm teaching, you are a eternal guest. So I want to extend that to you first. God bless you for who you are and your networks and always plugging into our live wire. So thank you. This evening is Friday nights at the De Young Museum, and it's a kind of evening that is cultivated to grasp, like, many different audiences. But what's special about this evening, particularly with Samba Da, is a hot Brazilian band, but what's beautiful about it is how they unite the peoples through their music, through their culture, bringing Brazilian dance and drum culture, but they also play Afro, Samba, Funk, Pop, and then some of the traditional. And they had a spectacular ensemble of musicianships joining them. And one of the particular highlights, particularly for me, that I identify with is this battery of drummers from Salvador da Bahia, Brazil. And they bring in a authentic local Afro sound. And so what's significant about that is this year is 40 years of Ile Aye, which is the first black local Afro movement started in Salvador Bahia, Brazil, very much influenced by the civil rights movement here in the United States. And so we have original members from Ile Aye. That's including the vocalist Donda Da Ora, who is this beautiful, talented spirit. She's a dancer. She's a vocalist. She's a teacher. She's a major force in the Bay, and she's a lead singer with Samba Da, as well as Papiba Godinho, who is also a capoeira mestre. He's also a beautiful vocalist and musician as well. And then it's rounded out by a full band with guitar and brass, and a shout out to my girl Annie, who plays with like three or four different instruments. And then this sound that has the Bahia sound, featuring members who are from Ile Aye, like Julio Jimenez, Macio, Wagner, and then you have over from Bizarchi, Abel Damasceno, Lucas Damasceno, Helio. And so all of this excitement is going to jump off this evening at the DeYoung Museum at Wiley Court, and it's the what's called Brazilian Night. And so for anyone really wanting to get into the spirit of carnival, I would say come this evening to DeYoung for Friday nights at DeYoung. And then Saturday,
Before you go on Saturday, I want to give people the address for the Samba Da Carnival Tour with Regina Khalifa.
Please.
It's at 50 Hagawara Tea Garden. So that's spelled H-A-G-I-W-A-R-A.
Correct.
So the 50 Hagawara Tea Green Drive in San Francisco from 6 to 8:30 p.m. and it's free. Mm-hmm. So
yes,
all you need to do is just get there, and if you get there early enough, you can find parking in there.
That's right.
That will be really fun.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And then we go into Carnival Motion over at Carnival San Francisco, and this year is headed by the charismatic and veteran leadership of Roberto Hernandez, and the Samba Da will be at the Carnival stage Saturday at 3 p.m. at 17th and Harrison Street. That will be Saturday at 3 p.m. at 17th and Harrison Street in the Mission District. And the thing about this Carnival stages is there are a number of Carnival stages at different sites and locations with some of the most talented and acclaimed bands, some local, some national, some international, world, cultural, down-home, traditional, contemporary. It will be in true festive fashion as we're celebrating 36 years Carnival San Francisco. And the festival stages are Saturday and Sunday as well. And then that night at the chapel, Samba Da is the premier Carnival destination for your pre-Carnival festive excitement. And we'll be at the chapel at 777 Valencia Street. The doors open, I believe, at 8
8
That's
o'clock,
correct.
And the show
at
starts
8.
At 9.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we'll be joined by Neguinha Sambista. She's from the Aquarela School, which is a longtime celebrated samba school in the Bay Area, and some of the other musicianships, dancers featuring Queen Veronica Howard Soto, who's Queen of Carnival 2013. She had a beautiful exit pageantry at this year's King and Queen contest. And then also joined by myself, which I am going to be in sheer heaven with all that beautiful sound inspiring my feet. I'll probably be flying on stage. So
yeah.
I'm really looking forward, yes.
So, Regina, Khalifa, is Samba Da also going to be at the chapel with you? Are they performing as well?
Samba Da is the headliner for the chapel, and so I'm just joining them on tour. These are really good friends of mine, and then good cohorts and musician friends. But the person who really invoked me is Donda Daora. We share a longstanding kinship dating back to I think like 91. In a cultural exchange when Ile Aye came here. And so I was particularly fond of the movement, was invited to go to Salvador de Bahia as their guest in 94, and I actually did that and participated with Ile Aye in Carnival that year and also with Olodum by way of Tanya Santiago and Ejnova. So that never left me, and I've certainly been back to Bahia subsequently, but it's definitely been an impetus and an inspiration in my own personal works in developing Carnival dance programming and bringing in the cultural narratives and, of course, my own personal journey in bridging our shared kinships through ancestral lineages. And so Donda now resides in California, and Samba Da is a Santa Cruz-based band, but is of Brazilian natives as well as, you know, local folks, talented musicians who make out for this really exciting sound of this expert talent. So they asked me to come and dance, and I said
right.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I was just thinking about you know, Salvador. I had an opportunity to visit Salvador you know, this early this year, end of December, January, and my last day there,
wow.
I actually got to go, you know, talk to Volvo, you know, grandfather.
You did?
And we were looking at each other, and, you know, I don't speak Portuguese, and he doesn't speak English,
sure.
And it's like, well, you know, where's your translator? It's like, well, I thought the brother would be here from last night. Well, he wasn't there. So we were, like, just looking at each other and smiling, and because the organization, you know, his mother started, is just so fantastic. I mean,
yes.
The building, you know, they have classes
yes.
for the children, you know,
yes.
dance classes and cultural classes so that the, you know, the people of that, the largest, one of the largest black
yes.
communities in Salvador, you know, with
yes.
the folks, is
yes.
black folks specifically, because, you know, not a lot of places in Brazil where you can see black people. You know, I mean,
sure.
everybody's black, but, you know, that look black.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And just like here, you know, black people aren't necessarily, particularly girls, are not necessarily proud of their, you know, melanin rich, you know, the richness of their
mm-hmm.
melanin content.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, with Iliaye, you know, the wonderful work they're doing is, you know, having the...
Yes.
The pageant, you know, where they have, you know,
yes.
Miss Black.
Delta, the Beleza Negra, Delta do Evanu. Yeah, to
mm-hmm.
that, you know, one of the things that were the highlights for the King and Queen contest this year was Queen Veronica Howard Soto. She's actually from Augusta, Georgia. And so in her pageant, her exit pageant, what was unique in working with Donda is that we were able to bring that element forward. We find it's necessary to remember those traditions of the African presence inside of these carnival traditions, and particularly with Brazil. And even though it has a contemporary extension, a lot of it is steeped in African spiritual traditions. You spoke of Mai Gilda Jitulu, who is Presidente Vovô's mom. She was a Mai de Santo. And so any time he let hit the streets had to be blessed by the Mais before folks went forward to process into Carnival. And, you know, and that just brings it all in perspective with regard to Circle of Life and to keep these traditions vital, but also to keep us ourselves vital as well. And so that's what's been unique about having Donda here is us finally to bring these visions manifested through these works. Although there is the platform through dance and music and performance and entertainment, we use that platform to bring forth these teachings, that education, and certainly cultivate those issues important to our communities and our legacies. So, I mean, I think that's so beautiful. You've got to witness that in. Yeah, this is shared kinship right now, this moment. Yes,
mm-hmm.
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, with Volvo, I always like taking, you know, things for the children when I travel. And so I had, like, all these gifts and things I got from the dollar store,
uh-huh.
you know, off of all
uh-huh.
the 12, or is it East International?
uh-huh.
You know, it's one of my favorite dollar stores.
East 14.
And it was,
yes.
Yeah, East 14th, right, exactly. And, you know, since it was the Christmas season, they had a lot of good stuff there. So I got puzzles and coloring books and crayons and things for the kids' hair and all kinds
right.
of really fun. So I had like a suitcase full of stuff. And I'm like getting ready to leave, and I'm like, man, I haven't been able to give it away yet. I haven't been able to, like, meet any, you know, organizations that are working with
uh-huh.
community, and so then I you know, of course, everyone knows Iliaye because they're
right,
and Dr. Caillou brought them here many
mm-hmm.
years ago,
exactly.
And but it's been too long
them.
Though.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah, we need
I
to get
agree.
Them back
because
it would be great to bring them back like next year celebrating
mm-hmm.
the 20th anniversary of the MAVA commemoration.
Mm-hmm.
And Volvo says, like, he's game, you know, we raise the money. Because they come here, they come to this country, but they're only on the East Coast. They don't come West.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, been some small ensemble contingencies, and also they've been in New Orleans for the Jazz Fest, a couple of festivals
mm-hmm.
In the past few years. But to the Bay, you're right, there needs to be a full-throttle initiative to bring them to the Bay, because we certainly have a deep reverence for their works and a shared kinship in their work. So
oh,
with you,
yeah.
I agree. You do something like that, you let me know, I'm in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
so in. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. So, you know, I was staying in Pellerino, you know, where there's a Zumbi mm-hmm. statue, and Oladum, the school was right across from the hostel where I stayed. So I could
right.
look in through the windows and see the classes. So I was
beautiful.
Wondering, I want you to, you know, announce what's going on Monday, but then I want you to come back and maybe
yes.
give us a little history mm-hmm. of the carnival. Like, what is it?
Well,
what does it mean?
Well, essentially, what's going on Monday with Oakland Carnival is in its transcendental form from what we hearken to about Kari Jama, but it is Oakland Carnival as contained unto itself. And it's led by the initiative after Kari Jama was, I would say, disemboweled, the initiative to meet and gather. Just as a tradition that we do amongst ourselves anyway, is spirited by carnival contingents. And so that this saying has been led by Brother Theo of Samba Funk and of Caribe Link Omnimedia and held at the Malunga Cascador Center. And so this year the city has joined in with Council Member Lynette McElhaney, the City of Oakland, and, of course, Legacy Dimensions Dance Theater. And in that, what I mean is that there actually will be a stage and there will be a parade, not a parade, but I'm going to say a processional, around park procession around the park. But most importantly, it's going to be an opening ancestral blessing starting at 10 a.m. to remember the names and, most importantly, to imbue sustained activity amongst us with these kind of traditions. Those kind of things, regardless of the forces that's happening, cannot disembowel which brings us together. And so we're a little bit celebratory about this year because of reconvening in a more official format in that the city is has joined in other elements to see that this happens. And then with regard to Carnival, Carnival has a couple of different veins as it relates to the Bay Area of its inception. Of course, you've heard one of the most infamous ones about the Mission District with names like Adela Chu, Marcus Gordon, Gloria Tulsi, and I'm told that one of the pioneering members of Carnival Traditions, Ms. Adela Chu, will be in the Bay Area this year. And then you have from Trinidad and Tobago, I have to mention Ms. Connie Williams, who's the matriarch of Oakland Carnival and those parties that she used to have in the Fillmore. And then, of course, there's the legendary Fatou Kaje, who were actually doing their version of Carnival with Jose Lorenzo and, of course, our beloved Jackie Barnes. And so you have these three veins that come together as our pillars for Bay Area Carnival traditions and still sustaining themselves, creating generations that are now in years of celebration, like 25 years of Foganahopa, 20 years of Loco Bloco. And then we have the tie-ins with 40 years of Jamanakura, and this year we're going to have the Malunga Fest at the Malunga Cascador Center for the Arts. Of course, these people were all kinship to the birth of Carnival and in the Bay Area. So we're very fortunate to still, in this economy and certainly with the state of things, of relationships on city levels, to be able to gather as a people and raise up these traditions. There have been many before us that are not here who saw fit to enrich our lives with these legacies, so it behooves us to stay in service to make sure they maintain themselves. So those are some of the historical elements I see important to make mention of this year.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, and I heard Carlos Acentuna's group, but I didn't hear his name called. I just wanted you to call his name because he's a wonderful ancestor, definitely did a whole lot here, for Pan-African music and dance.
Well, it's interesting because I tend to give him his special place because as it relates to me. With Carlos Sasatuno, much of my work, when we speak about Khalifa da Bahia or Enzo Khalifa dance work or even me going to Brazil, so much of that was invoked through the dynamic partnering and friendship that I had with Carlos Sasatuno that I still maintain, ideally. And he hails from Quetzaltenango, Guatemala, came here as a student, and his background was of the conservatory that in Guatemala and also in San Francisco. I went to San Francisco State, trained with Lars, Alicia Pierce, and of course he was one of the earliest members of Batu Kaje, and then blazed his own trails through Fulan Ahopa, founded in 89. I was working with the festival organization in 1990, and we had booked them for Ghirardelli Square, and that's how I met Carlos. And from there, our kinship was the most powerful through creating, and he was so instrumental in bridging some of the works I would bring through the African foundations. He already was a strong kinship with Tamalonga and Jose Nem, and so bridging those things, we created a very powerful organization that became a year-round carnival organization and programming, not just performing, but also classes in capoeira, dance, and music. And also through that, too, is a very he was an activist in the sense that, you know, he did not let any grass grow under his feet if he felt like there's a certain voice that needed to be given attention to, especially when it came to youth and certainly when it came to rights and then anything that had to do with advocacy for the artist. We had a very sophisticated quality in not speaking it but doing it by moving masses of people through his expertise. And so we called him the Pied Piper of Carnival then, so you can imagine what kind of horn he's tooting up above. And so certainly we lift his name in love and light and, you know, give him this special moment in these celebrations as well. The one thing about when we talk about these traditions for some of us at the Malanga Center, we can never speak of these things without calling on Carlos and Malanga's name, and they seem to run in pairs, you know, on the ground and up above, and we'll say, oh, that's Carlos, oh, God, Malanga's here. You know, they seem to come in pairs like that. So I think that's a reflection of the beautiful friendship and the dynamic partnering of their works that still live within us here in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what we say is Ashe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just thinking also, thinking about Legba, and I was thinking about, you know, Legba likes, you know, threes, and then I thought about Edsel Matthews, right? So,
go, girl.
Yeah. So we can't leave Edsel out of there, out of the Trinity, yep. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for saying that. Edsel was the horn. He was going to be heard, but he was a brain cultural trust in arts administration and advocacy, and he certainly was our foremost advocate and leader in, you know, breaking through affairs having to do with city bureaucracies and just bringing to light blueprints for models of arts administration and management. So, yes, love and light to Brother Edsel Matthews.
Yeah, because with Edsel's, I mean, you know, what our ancestors that we're talking about, you know, Edsel Matthews, Carlos Sasatuno, and Malanga Kaskalord, you know, we think about them, we think this is our Iliaye in the Bay, right? I mean, that building. And then we think over in the city, you know, with Wajumbe and Dr. Caillou, that's our Iliaye in the city. And, you know, And these institutions are still standing, and there have been battles, you know, about taking them away. And then we think about, you know, sort of the black rep in Berkeley. You know, that's an Iliaye space. You know, these are like our institutions of culture. And there are always these battles about, oh, they're not doing enough with, let's take it back.
Well, you know,
or let's take it away or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that certainly with regard to the Malanga Kaskalord Center for the Arts, and I, you know, it formerly was a women's building, the Alice Arts Center. I remember Brother Chriswell Muhammad us having an exchange in front of the center about, you know, just who is community, like when we speak community. And so we break it down commune plus unity. Who are you in commune with? And so when there are exaltations or beautiful creations, powerful works like this, there's bound to be forces to take it down. It started to get extremely intricate on a city level, a government official level, just never to supersede the good works of the people. And sometimes amongst us ourselves as people, more than the talk, we got to do the walk. We have to sit down, not just plan, but in a very sophisticated, strategic fashion, begin to bind things on paper, or, you know, pull out our architects, or, you know, legally bind things, or acquisitions. These kind of things have to be ongoing, not just in the midst of crisis or upon an event. And so when I think about the Malunga Koskalora Center for the Arts, and having been an advocate for a long time in that building, I think maybe since 93, you know, I saw it go change hands in many way, and often stigmatized as a stepchild, which I think is diminishes the significance of the ambassadorship in that building, you know. And I also always saw a vision of a brilliant marketing plan for it, and even submitted a document to the city before his untimely death. And it was a blueprint to really take it to next level and a higher status than where it is now. Now, don't get me wrong. I always give reverence to the achievements and the workings of good people, especially in managing people. But in some benchmarks were missed with that particular building. And so for me, for the people that still work there, that still cultivate, that still build, my hat's off to them. I always wish them, you know, a good word, because some very important people in that building are no longer with us for reasons associated with the work. You know what I'm saying? So we have to get a little bit more mindful about our work and how we do it, who we do it with, and so that it is still standing and it's feeding us and we're prospering, and every word counts, every good word counts. And so you're right about what's interesting about ELE is ELE was very much influenced by our civil rights movement. And they give reverence to that. They have placed it in their books, in their fabric, and I like to see more preservation-like activities happen with us with regard to our histories. You know what I'm saying? What library is it in? What institution is it preserved in, so that the generations coming up have a place to make reference to, and they can speak like I'm speaking, because I was actually with these architects, and I'm a voracious reader and student of life always and of my works. This is the kind of education we need to cycle into these artworks, not just on stage. And so when I think about the Malunga Center and that it's held in his name, it's not a building, just a building for me. Every time we call his name, we invoke. You know what I'm saying? And yeah, that's what keeps me mindful. And I ask that people who walk through those doors think about it the same. You know what I'm saying? And his seeds, Mushi Kongo, Lungusu, Kiazi, Wesa, they live and they thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And the
yeah.
generation is still building, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Certainly. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you're homegrown, Oakland native, you know. 25-year history of performance and choreography and production. And I was wondering, so did you come through San Francisco State? Because San Francisco State used to be the place where you could, like, travel the diaspora, you know, with performance art. A lot of those wonderful professors have retired. Like, you know,
yeah.
Dr. Alberta
yeah.
Rose, you know, I think she
yeah.
was the last
She's
one.
A
and so now,
soul. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So did you come mm-hmm. through there? Is that how you sort of became, like,
That's interesting.
The power dynamic
no.
woman that you are presently?
God bless you. It's interesting because a lot of people thought I went to San Francisco State. And I actually, I'm going to say the way I came through dance was through my mother's womb. And she will tell you I was moving the whole 9 months. And she will tell you this tumultuous story of how I was birthed. And she used to dance with Ms. Ruth Becker. Ms. Ruth Becker was her teacher.
Oh.
And yes. So that's our first lady of dance in Oakland, Ms. Ruth Beckford. And, of course, we know the legacy of Ms. Ruth Beckford being a principal dancer with the Dunham Company. And so That's how she was read. Also, my auntie, her name is Katie Waters, and she came up through Laney College Dance Department. So knee-high, I was at Laney College Dance Department with my mother. Deborah Vaughn was her colleague, and Ellen Dar Barnes was over the department at Laney. And so that's how I came up through dance, and also through Oakland Parks and Rec, through all the centers. And then I went to Berkeley High. I went to Berkeley High because they had a particular class in music theory that I wanted to take. And from there, I met Paula McCullum. And Paula McCullum was over the dance department. And if you can imagine at Berkeley High, we had Mr. Navies, Mr. Austin, who was extremely progressive in African-centered thought. And so was it in dance. And so in our dance classes, we learned Congolese dance, we learned samba, because Paula was studying with people like Tama Longa, Titos, and Jose, and Jackie. So she'd bring it to the class, and those were some of my early introductions. She was very fierce. Her background was Dunham as well. Her teachers was Alberta Rose. And so from there I went to San Jose State. That's where I went.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
And so, yep. And I took that with me there, continued in dance. But I felt like Oakland was its own institution unto itself. So I enjoyed when people like Imbayero, Carlos, Mr. Acordeon came to San Jose, because that would further imbue my inspiration to stay in dance or start my own company, go back and forth to Oakland. And then, of course, when I got out of San Jose State, my first order of business was to get back and join Foi de Congo. And that's what I did. I remember in high school, Paula would say, you could either go this trek and go for Ailey, and or you can go through Foi de Congo. That's how she presented it to us, like it was on same level. And I was called by the drum, so I was like, I aspire to be in Foi de Congo. It was like our African Ailey, so to speak, you know?
You know,
and
that's such a great analogy. That's so true.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, because mm-hmm. Deborah danced with Foi. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a lot of giants, Dr. Faye, Knox, McNair Knox, and Jeannie Ishman Brown, and Regina Ndunda, and Cynthia Phillips, and my Karen Ransom, who I'm still dancing with her today. You know, Fred Simpson, there's a number of people, like, that trail still blazes. And so those are my formative years. And you remember the Mondaleo Institute with the Lexepo brothers?
Yes,
and,
yes, that was really wonderful. Mm-hmm.
The beautiful, powerful bridging of African dance, drum, and culture. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Of all of those, I think there were like three main ones of all of those great institutions. Diamanakora is still standing and still presenting.
Yes, it is. They're 40 years this year, and so they're getting ready to do some major stuff coming up, and already in planning in motion. And they have like three or four generations going through the company, which is beautiful village in motion and building, you know. So,
Yeah, our royalty, huh?
Yes, and, you know, I feel blessed because I'm imbued in all of that, and so I feel great responsibility to teach and transfer and to preserve, you know. That's my ongoing format.
So what did you end up getting your degree in? Was it in dance or performance?
That's so funny. No, it was in Afro-American studies. It had a strong psychology bent, and it was a double minor in marketing and speech communication. Mm-hmm. That was my degree. And
so like
I say
black
Afro-American
psychology?
Studies. Yes. Mm-hmm. That was the center. Yeah, and it's interesting because at the time, I'm not going to say it was frowned on, but I was in the Silicon Valley, so people didn't see how that would make money, you know. But my thought was I was already working in the Silicon Valley. That's how I paid my tuition. Mm-hmm. So I didn't need to get my degree in it. That was my thought. And I wanted to do what was in my heart. And I'm so grateful for that decision, you know, because now look at how that field has really shown itself, and it is extremely necessary. And it's really imbued and informed my dance and the way I teach, definitely.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I was just thinking about Jackie Barnes. How is she?
She's beautiful, and we sat side by side one another at the King and Queen contest. She's sharp. She's actually teaching at is the Fitness San Francisco, but this location is in Oakland over there on Grand Avenue. She teaches on Mondays at 9 a.m. and she is Samba Fierce. Please go and take the class. Try her.
9 a.m. on Monday.
Try.
Okay.
Yes, 9 a.m. She's fierce. She's fierce. So it was really a joy to sit between her and Brother Thomas Seon, who is Caribbean pioneer of carnival traditions in the Bay. I sat between those two pillars as a judge for the King and Queen contest this year.
Oh,
and
you were
it
a judge.
Was,
okay.
I was.
Wow. Nice.
Completely amazing. I had the best time. I really did. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very excited because I think that, you know, that event really set the course in motion for this year's Carnival Excitement. And so I also want to shout out to Roberto Hernandez, because he's a longtime friend and kinship and, you know, has reemerged to invoke some excitement and support for Carnival San Francisco, and he's bringing up another generation to sustain it at the same time. He's a tireless worker and activist as well, so... Shout out to Roberto Hernandez and the community that supports Carnival San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're doing shout outs, definitely need to mention Avacha because she goes way back to Carnival. You know, the stories
yes.
of the when it was in the Fillmore before it got moved.
Yes.
You know, where it is
right.
presently. Mm-hmm. Like
yes.
that history.
I love Tia.
Mm-hmm.
She's been getting all kind of recognitions and accolades this year, you know. And sometimes these events are not the same unless we hear her velvet voice, you know, bask over it, layer it to open up ceremony. So we don't feel like it's official sometime until we hear her voice. So, yes, shout out to Avacha. Hopefully she'll still want to be around us.
Yeah, and then I was thinking about Val Sorant, you know,
yes.
holding it down for Trinidad and Tobago, you know, with Sisters with Styles. I mean, those young women that he groomed, I mean, they're grown, and they have their own school and their own, you know, cultural center in Oakland, and they're going to be in the parade, and it's like they're just doing
yes.
wonderful things. Mm-hmm.
Sisters with Style are amazing. I remember when they first started. And the sisters that started, I remember, yeah, they were fairly young. It was Sister Marissa Lyons, Valencia Newton, and Kiana Rochelle. And Valencia actually is the queen of carnival this year from Sisters of Style. They put it down. They brought it.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
So she's the queen of carnival this year. Mm-hmm.
Oh, good for her. Yeah, and then
yes.
think about Marty, or Citizen Payne, you know, who made his transition
yes.
a few months ago. You know, one of the founders
mm-hmm.
of Caribbean All Stars, and
yes.
I remember they would talk
yes.
about the carnival in Trinidad and Tobago. I mean,
yes.
I mean,
yes.
really, you haven't experienced carnival until you're in the African diaspora. And then it's like, oh,
no.
my goodness.
Mm-hmm. And I think about Moss Makers Massive with the giant puppets. And
yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, and Stephen and Colleen. And I think they're definitely over 35 years in the tradition here in the Bay. Although, you know, that's something he grew up with. But there were 35 years of Moss Makers Massive in the Bay, and certainly pioneers of the Kari Jama legacy, too.
Mm-hmm.
The Midas International was another group, Islands of Fire. Margaret Haynes, remember Margaret at the Old Caribbee? Margaret and Steve
yes,
Haynes.
Yes, yes.
Yes, Jackie mm-hmm. Artman, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mhm, mhm,
yeah.
And
yeah.
mm-hmm. so we're naming. What's beautiful about this conversation, and you know, it's making me—I don't know—it loosens me up, and it gives me a lot of feel good that there is much to celebrate. You know, for those who've transitioned, when we speak their names, we send them light, and they give it right back to us. So I'm
mm-hmm.
feeling that in this moment. Thank you.
Nice. Yeah. I was thinking again about Maishi Carlos, and I was just thinking about when I first saw Fogo Naropa, that was my first experience with the Bloco, because it was just like,
I mean,
when they hit, it's like, it was like they just sort of took up the whole space.
Thunder. When it's,
I mean, it's
thunder.
Thunder. Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah. Who's the Orisha for Thunder? Shango? Yeah, it was like Shango was coming through, right?
I knew you were going to go there. I just knew it. I felt it. You know, interesting enough, in his transition, we had did, you know, a farewell ceremony class at the Malunga Center. There were so many people in that room. We thought the floor was going to cave in. And Jose Rivera, who is now the musical director for Fogana Hopa, led the bateria that day. And I remember when the first drums hit, it was almost like supersonic. And there's this one dancer, his name is Jose Chio Rojas. He came in, he's from Cuba, and he just started dancing for Shango. You know, just immediately start dancing for Shango. And another dancer came in. She was from Brazil. She called Shango's name. And I just looked and I smiled, you know. Jorge Alabe, who has his own group, Grupo Samba de Rio, came in just to simply say hi. He's a priest of Shango. He was very close to Carlos. They were like brothers, you know. And so that's the vital force that transcends and emanates from these works is the reason why we need to give reverence and stay mindful as to how we do it. It's more than just the spectacle, you know, and presenting and putting on stuff. It's these things that we're talking about that come with that, how these people were influenced and imbued, which made their work so excellent. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it inspires you to continue in that excellence. Sometimes some of these catchphrases like, oh, we celebrate the legacy and we continue the tradition. No. Let it be a service through your works. This is what I say, because that's who these people were. That's what they exemplify. And so when we speak of Carlos, I always think about the excellence and the tenacious works in lifting it in that kind of light. It was very determined and dutiful in his music, in his dance, and in youth. And music definitely was his love. So to compose and arrange, that's how he was trained. So it was no wonder that the sound was what it was, you know?
Right, yeah.
So I smile. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right.
I smile.
Yeah, because when I was, I went to a couple of candomblé ceremonies. I went to two, actually. And then I was just asking around, so what's the prediction of, what's the forecast for 2014? And mm-hmm. sort of, and who are the Orisha that are like sort of presiding around
mm-hmm.
the energy? And if I remember correctly, someone told me that in the reading,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, oh, and I just thought about that, you know, when we were talking, and I remember seeing Carlos, in some of the traditional folkloric performances.
Mm-hmm.
I remember
mm-hmm.
one time he was so embodied by the spirit of
mm-hmm.
of the Orisha that I didn't even recognize him. And I was wondering, I'm seeing Shango colors, and I'm wondering, did he ever dance Shango?
You're asking me if he ever danced Shango, really?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I'm joking when you when I with
yeah
you when
yeah
I'm
I know
saying
I know I know I know you're asking. I mean, you're joking. I was like, really? Because I can see it in my mind. I'm like, yeah.
Well, it's interesting. There was this beautiful creative dynamics work. It was started by Michael Spiral and Marcus Lamson.
Yeah.
No, not Mark
mm-hmm.
Lamson. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Batu Ketu Project. And
I remember
inception.
That.
Yeah. Yep. And the
that,
CD
that was
is
the
still excellent. Yes. And that performance,
mm-hmm.
you know, Carlos danced for Eshu and he danced for Shango.
Okay.
And
okay.
Yes. Yes, he did. And so that was at the Malunga Center. Yep.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
there is a tape that I think was the Oakland, the local Oakland TV station that sometimes comes and do tapings. Is it KTOP?
KTOP, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. They taped it. And so, yeah. And so that's on archive. Absolutely. The Batu Ketu project at the Malunga Center. It might have been
called
the Avatar
Center.
Do you have a copy of that? I do. That's interesting.
Oh, good.
I do.
Good,
I know that you will need to see it. Okay, great.
Yeah, I like to see that again. Yeah, I was there. Because I could see him dancing in my mind.
Oh, wow. God bless you.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm just calling, you know, Carlos's name, but I just sort of,
so
I don't
beautiful.
Know. I just sort of feel like him right at the moment. His
I
energy. Maybe because whenever I talk to you, I think of him.
Oh, God bless you. I appreciate that. That touches me. It makes me smile. It's the quintessential nature that makes our relationship special still to this day. And I cherish it in a very sacred way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your testimony, it's a testament to that, what makes special about Carlos and how we're related. So thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, thank you for all of your work. So tell us, once the celebratory weekend, which starts and continues through Monday, and then the next day you have your classes, right? Thursday you have your classes.
So
tell us, those of us that are interested in taking your class, what does it entail?
we're having a good time, I want to say that. And this is at the Web Oakland. And the Web stands for Women Enter Boldly. So that first attracted me to this space.
Oh,
and it's managed.
Nice.
Yes. And that,
oh, say
okay.
that again. Women Enter. Web. Say that again. Oh,
women,
wow. I want to make sure I heard you right.
Women Enter Boldly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so it's managed by Jasmine McLean. She's known on the set as Beja. And she's an entrepreneur. She's also a carnavalesco by way of loco. But she has her own trek. And so this is one of the ventures that she has taken on. And she invited me to come. Really held space for me at the studio. At the time, I was in some deep study work, as I am an aspiring genealogist, and bringing in this project called Dancer Story. And what I want to do is to bring up the stories in and around these dancers here in the Bay Area and around the African dance and drum community. Let's talk about your family lines. Let's talk about how you're inspired by dance, drum, and culture. And let's look at it, you know, with the science and the tools that we have by way of technology. Let's look at your oral stories and let's look at it by way of spirit. So I really submitted myself to some on-the-ground field work starting in my own backyard, and she held space for me as my elders were saying, okay, we need you to teach. And so I had to go back into the studio and teach dance, but I wanted to do it in a different way, more intimate, where I can bring in cultural narratives and introduce these stories, like when we talk about Ile Aye and the underpinnings of these organizations, how it influenced the movement, therefore your dance, and so that we're dancing with more supple bodies, mindful intention, and more expression, and hopefully in that there is the healing. So at the Web Oakland, we're doing the Carnival Dance Series, where we are focusing on Bloco Afro and celebration with 40 years of Ile Aye. It's going into that style, that signature style that they execute, bringing in a lot of Candomblé traditions inside of their movement, bridged with some contemporary styling. And then we talk about, you know, those things that you were introduced to in Bahia, like Beleza Negra, the pageant, Delso do Ebonu, the schools, My Yilda, the things that are going on with our folks there, how it affects the people here, that kind of thing. So we do that. And we, of course, naturally are introduced to movements in jazz and Dunham technique as well. Some contemporaneo, which is the contemporary with Afro-Brazilian traditions. My teacher, Mestre Kingi, teachers from Ballet Folklorico da Bahia, some of the training that I've gotten from them. And we bridge that into the learning experience every Thursday from 6 to 7:30. The Carnival Dance Series at the Web started April 17th, and this session ends on June 26th. I go into field work. I go into the lab. And then I come back in 2 weeks to pick back up at the Web. But for anybody who wants to be in contact with me, they can always email me at Khalifa, C-A-L-I-F-A, at Yahoo, no, excuse me, Khalifa510@yahoo.com. On Facebook, I have a page called Enzo Khalifa Dance Works. Enzo, that's N is in Nancy Khalifa Dance Works. And so you can find out what's going on there. And then also I have a blog, which is called Enzo Khalifa Blog Works, Blogspot. So if you even just Google Enzo Khalifa, all of my platforms will come up. And I'm looking to take this into the community, but I have a personal vision to get 50 women, 50 and over, to come together as a, yes.
Oh, count me in, girl. I want to be one of those women. Oh, I want to be in your group.
Yes, it's done. Okay, I got you, because I don't forget. I'm really good about this. It's kind of been on for about 2 or 3 years. To come together as a wing, as a contingent, as a dance society.
Yeah, and oh, a dance society. How fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, because I've been wanting to take your class since I took that one class when you were honoring Oshimare. And
yes.
Yeah,
oh,
and that's like, that was so beautiful the way you, because I've never taken, I know you teach, but I've never taken any of your classes. And that was my first time experiencing you as a teacher. And I'm like, oh, this is so good. Yeah, I still feel the warmth of that.
Oh, thank you.
That experience, and it's like, oh, yes. So anyway, I'm glad you sent me this email. I know that you're doing this on Thursday. Okay.
God bless you, because you picked it up so quick and got right on it. But then that's just what you do. And I was just like, well, she's on it. Let me get on it. And I cannot miss, you know, such a connection with you. We love how it is that you raise voice and give time and attention to the works we're doing, and then you're involved, you're engaged. And that's what I love about you. So thank you so much. I deeply appreciate having this platform and having this opportunity. It's grounding me so much for this weekend. Very much,
yeah,
so.
Well, you're going to just have this wonderful weekend starting this evening at the
yes.
Young Museum. I want to let
that's
our audience
right.
know again, you know, at the you know, this free event. Let me get back to where it is. Here we are. The Samba Da Carnival Tour with, you know, R. Khalifa. And it's 6 to, 6 to 8:30 p.m. Brazilian night is free.
Yes, yes.
At it's 50 Hajiwara T. Green Drive. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like at the end of the museum, right? It's sort of like,
right?
Like, yeah, yes. It's not hard. It's easy to find.
I think it's the botanical gardens near that area, that kind of thing. It is easy to find, absolutely. Yeah, you can access
and, you know,
it from the loop.
Exactly. You'll hear the music. Just follow the music.
Okay. And believe me, I just want to say with Samba Da, Samba Da is not a band. It's an experience. It really is. And before too long, you realize while you're dancing that you're having a great experience, more so than dancing to a band. You're completely enveloped by the music, and the infectious quality of the musicianship is more engaging than it is just us spectating. So that's one. But then when you see Danda Da Ora perform and sing, she's like a muse. You know, a siren. I'm going to say that. She was like a siren. You are asphyxiated upon her in her spins, in her song, how she teaches combinations for the audience to dance, you know, popular styles from Bahia. So it really is an experience. They have something prepared special for this year's carnival. So for anyone coming to see Samba Da, whether at Dayang tomorrow or tomorrow at the carnival stage, you know, at 3 o'clock, 17th and Harrison, and finally at the chapel that night in San Francisco. Believe me, folks will come away with a memorable experience and having truly enjoyed themselves in carnival, definitely. So I will be there flying. Yes.
Yeah, and I guess you'll touch down in Oakland on Monday. You'll be in the air.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's going to be
that
really nice.
Well said. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it'd be really great to talk to, you know, the current queen, you know, maybe because her reign is for the whole year. It's not just this weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
And,
yes, it
and
is.
And then also be great to talk to Dandada, Aura, and Pabiba, because, yeah, and some of the other members about Salvador and about, you know, the tradition, which isn't just, you know, a weekend either. It's a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually not a lifestyle. It's a way of life,
mm-hmm.
you know, that has
mm-hmm.
helped, you know, our people survive in the diaspora away from home, you know, all these centuries. Well, actually, just one century. No, actually, no, it's
right.
been 500 years. Yeah, quite
yes,
a few. But
centuries.
We're still black.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing? Like,
yes.
We're still African.
Honey.
We're still black. And but we've
Bees.
Been away from home all
yes.
these hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. It's a science, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the inception of creation, so it doesn't die out. You can try to die it down, but it doesn't die out. It sustains
mm-hmm.
itself, and it's a living element and a vital source. So if we think of ourselves in that way, there is can be a more mindful intention about preserving ourselves better as well, too. And, you know, that's just really what this dance thing is for me. It's a mediumship for service in that way, for healing, for transformation, and, you know, for uplift. And so I'm pleased to be doing it. I'm blessed to be doing it, but I'm challenged this weekend. I'm like, oh, you got to come off these computers, come out the library, honey, and you have to dance. I'm like, oh, my God, okay, here we go. But
yeah,
but
wow.
Yeah, but Carnival, if I had to think of any inspiration to just get me launched, believe me, this mm-hmm. is it. And so I really encourage everyone to come out this year. This year has some special highlights planned for the work that is being done through Carnival San Francisco and Oakland Carnival at Mosswood Park.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
so,
Aridama,
you know.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there aren't that many festivals anymore, particularly African Center festivals. They've all kind of been shut down. And so it's really great that you know, on a smaller scale, Karijama continued, you know, sheer persistence. And,
right.
And now it's gotten recognition and support again from the city government. And it is. It's just really, really wonderful. You know, you've been flying, you know, from today, and you're still in the air. Saturday, Sunday, you're in the air. And then
yes.
on Monday, you can like, glide down and, you know, and,
yes.
and just come to a nice, warm landing, you know.
Yes.
You know, in
yes.
Oakland, which is really a different kind of vibe than San Francisco,
yes,
even though
mm-hmm.
people are going to be in San Francisco who are from the East Bay, because most people live
right.
in the East Bay, not in San Francisco.
mm-hmm. And a lot of people from San Francisco, I have some, you know, friends who just moved from San Francisco to Oakland, you know,
mm-hmm.
a number of people, and, you know, some of the dynamics in and around that. In some ways it's sweet, in other ways it's not that savory. But, you know, in that my grandfather coming from Pioneer, Louisiana, and my grandmother as well came here to, I would say give us options, because my grandfather still believes in cultivating our own backyard, so I find it necessary to go to Louisiana often as well. But to give us options, and I just think it's a beautiful thing in that, you know, this, my tradition, my family tradition was able to obtain land, you know, to obtain housing, to obtain the kind of things that are taken for granted and even taken away now. And sometimes people think these times are better than the old days, but there's some things I appreciate about those times that we're struggling with now, you know what I'm saying? And so when I think about Oakland, it makes me think fondly, but also keeps me determined, you know, to stay woke, so to speak.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting that you would talk about, you know, Louisiana. It's so funny, I was going to close our conversation with a song, a Mardi Gras song from Michelle Jacques, because I saw her last night.
You better go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, it's so funny. I saw her last night. She was a part of Kelly Tacunda Orphan's celebration
yeah.
of Zimbabwean music at the Great Savage. And And this particular week coming, is the San Francisco Green Film Festival, and they're looking at water, you know, in the West, and water security and dams,
yes,
and all this, you know, the water shortages and things like that. And there's a film called Come Hell or High Water, The Battle for Turkey Creek, which looks at a community in what's now called it's in the southern part of Mississippi, and it's really interesting that I'll tell you in a minute. It's really interesting that particular community, this land was bought by formerly enslaved African Americans, and these, I don't know, I think it was like I think there were like eight people, and and then what happened is over time the government, so they didn't want the land at first, the government started building, so now Turkey Creek is like at the center of Gulfport was like built around it. And so this particular story that director Leah Mahan tells of Derek and his family. Derek is he's like third generation perhaps, but he's the one that has sort of been telling the story of this place and what's left, because they're like slowly and slowly taking away all of this land that was owned by these black people. And it's marshland, which means it's supposed to be conserved anyway. And so it's a really beautiful film, and Derek is actually in town, and he wants to actually show the film in different places while he's in town, like show it in the East Bay and show it in Richmond, and have a reception when they show the film on the 31st. And so what I'm going to do is I'm thinking afterwards, you know, after you come down on Monday, maybe there might be a way maybe you might be interested in figuring out how we might be able to host him on this side of the bay, before he takes off.
Absolutely.
It's an important story, and with your work with a doc Ancestry, is that how you pronounce it?
Dancestry.
You know, similar type of work, you know,
absolutely,
preserving the legacies and telling the stories and documenting these stories so that they don't get lost.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, I'd definitely be interested. It definitely is in shared line of my works and interest in and around presenting that kind of programming or important information that communities should see. Please do let me know and count me in again.
Okay.
But most things you do, I like to be counted in, so definitely call upon me.
And I'm going to try to figure out, how I can – I'm supposed to, Allegra told me to be still and to get focused. I'm thinking, how can I work? I really want to come to the chapel on Saturday. How can I work that? So I'm going to try to figure out how I can, rearrange things so that I'm not scattered and I could come tomorrow night, because that seems like that's going to be phenomenal. I mean, everything's going to be great, but that sounds like, oh, my gosh.
Yes, it actually is going to be that what you think. I also want to, for people who may not make it to the chapel and want to know about Samba Da, they have a website called Samba Da. It's spelled Samba Da.com. So it's SambaDa.com. And folks can find out more about Samba Da, what they're doing, where they're going to be. They travel up and down the state, but also throughout the country. They've been in Philly, they've been in New York, they've been in New Orleans, and so Samba Da gets around. But to see this band, no, excuse me, experience this band, you come away with something to talk, more than something to talk about. It just brings a smile to your face, and you know that it's almost like you want to be a member. So, you know, not even a groupie, but like a devotee, so to speak, because this is the kind of music, action, and exchange you want to see transform faces, spaces, and places. And Samba Da does that.
Yeah, and devotee is the right term, though, because, you know, this is the music of the ancestors. You know, this they like
yes.
invoke. I mean, the reason why you feel like this is because they're calling spirit. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's why you're flying. I mean, not all kind of music, not all music makes people fly,
yeah.
but, you know, you be levitating and flying, and we're going to be, like, looking at you all around the venue and flying around, you know, Carnival, and, like, and then seeing you flying into Oakland and, like, oh, wow, look at her. Look at her beautiful, beautiful wings and, you know, like,
yes,
oh, my
honey.
Goodness.
Well, I say, if I'm going to fly, let it be bon aché. You know what I'm saying? Let it be of good spirit, of good work, mindful intention, and, you know, and I trust and surrender to that spirit. It's just time. Sometimes you need to allow yourself to be lifted by that which you enjoy doing. And so if I had to speak about Carnival, I think about it in those terms, too. You do the work, but this is the time to lift it. Let go of the rants, let go of the neurosis, let go of the drama. Some people... Don't get me wrong. Know that that's some of the byproduct of it, but, you know, there's so many other elements to hone in on it. And so I'm pleased to be engaged this way and you know, and to give back, too, at the same time. So, if the way is open, I do hope that you make it. But certainly if you don't, I pray to see you Monday at Oakland Carnival at Mosswood Park. I want to share that Brother Theo has asked that people who are coming, if they would bring their own garbage bags so that we can leave the park like we got it. He wants to put that message out and certainly bring a good spirit, bring prayer. And also I want to ask the community to really consider the backing of this initiative, in that the efforts of making it happen this year came with what I had learned, a $6,000 bill. Supposedly the initiative was tagged with $3,000 use tax for the subsequent years that they gathered. And in those instances, it really was just about people getting together on a Monday, on Memorial Day, what people do at parks, and that's the park they chose to be at. It didn't have no hoopla on it. It didn't have no critical mass. Everybody come out. It wasn't that. This is the year that it's made official. But upon applying for city funds to make it official this year, he also was met with a $6,000 bill. And so I'm petitioning that it's expunged, that it's waived, and or if we need to, that we raise funds for it. But although I find that effort ludicrous, if it's what is needed, what needs to happen, then we'll do that. But I just think we need to bring awareness to that, because when we do this kind of work, those are some of the things that we're taxed by and inherit. And I actually would like leaderships to be free of that kind of thing, so that they don't get taxed and their lives are not taxed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I want to keep people vital and living. Vital and living. So you can be in prayer about that too, and be asking some questions about that, and that not be attached to this initiative. That'd be great.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. The city of Oakland has funds for other things, so why tack a bill onto a city supported function? That doesn't make any sense. Because before the city was connected to it, like you say, it was free. People just got together. It was like really informal. It was happening, but it wasn't happening. You know, so like under the radar. And now we're not doing a guerrilla underground thing. We're like, you know, stepping up, you know, in the public eye, and like, oh, we're getting charged. Like, what?
And, you know, certainly I only make mention of those things that are documented. This is not hearsay. This is not gossip. It's just that was taken by it. So certainly I ask to see it. You feel what I'm saying? So
yeah.
It's familiar, but this is not the road we'd like to go, and we're not going to put anybody up to sacrifice for doing what one needs to do or supposed to do and continuing this legacy. So Let's give our brother Theo and this initiative that kind of support, proactive support
mm-hmm.
and voice in and around that while we are celebrating. And so, you know, I wanted to make mention of that.
Oh, certainly, certainly, yeah. And then we think about Memorial Day, you know, it's the day that we honor our dead. And that's a real African tradition. I mean, African people do that. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, we do
mm-hmm.
it. We do it out. We do it publicly, where in other traditions
mm-hmm.
are really quiet about honoring the Egun. You know, so
mm-hmm.
like in
mm-hmm.
Africa, yeah, definitely people should write letters to
absolutely
to the mayor and to council to waive this.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, thank
yes.
you for telling me. Yeah, and people can bring extra garbage bags if they have more.
Yes.
Those that don't.
Yes.
Yeah, we always want to leave a place better than we found it, for sure.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Ms. Regina Khalifa, for
so
joining
welcome.
Us. This is a great conversation, and looking forward to having subsequent ones, particularly after I come to your class and you can hook me up with the Samba Da folks that I'm going to meet.
Yes.
I'm really trying
yes.
to work.
Yes, you will.
I want to get there
yes.
Saturday night.
Okay, okay, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I will certainly extend the message to both Donda and Ms. Vanessa over at Sisters with Style to let them know you want to speak with them. And I'm sure I will definitely give them your information, no problem.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, tonight it's going to be simply fabulous. Enjoy yourself. And
thank
the stage
you.
Where you're going to be performing is a free stage, because everything at Carnival is not free, but that stage is.
Yes, it is.
Both days is a free stage, so you could do the
yes,
do the
is.
Parade on Sunday and just hang out at that stage. And if you don't have any money, you don't need any.
That's right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
yeah.
the beauty of it. Yeah, full
mm-hmm.
access. So
yeah.
please, people, come out, but keep your body supple, keep your mind right, and, you know, keep good ashe. And bon carnival to everybody.
Oh, bon carnival to you too, Sister Khalifa.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we're going to go out Michelle Jacques, the Mardi Gras song
okay.
about New Orleans. All right, peace and blessings.
Right on. Peace and blessings.
Mardi Gras Day, you might hear the wild pepper tula say.
Mardi, cool and fire, finale, finale. Mardi, cool and fire, finale, finale. My funky clothes.